I would remind everybody that this is an open meeting of the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. Thank you all very much for coming in this morning. I understand the weather coming in wasn't bad, but the weather going home will be. So we're going to do our best to keep this on our time schedule. I know that shocks you, but we'll do our best to get out of here by 2 o'clock, giving everybody the time they need to address every issue on the agenda. With that, we're going to start off with roll this morning. I'll just ask Stephen to take roll.
All right, let's start with the judges. Judge Conklin.
I'm here.
Present.
Judge Barton.
No
Judge Barton. Judge Cope.
I'm here.
Judge Earl.
Here.
Judge Good. Judge Good. Judge Hermans.
Here.
Judge Heinrichs.
Here.
Judge Holland. Judge Holland. Judge Coffin.
I'm here.
Judge Kuhl. Judge Kuhl. Judge Lee.
Here.
Judge Maragonda.
He's here.
He's here.
His name tag is here.
He's I
here.
Saw him.
No, he's here.
Okay, we'll note him as here. As present. Judge McCabe. Judge McCabe. Judge Saunders.
I'm here.
Judge Smith. Here. Okay, now the executive office. Sherry Carter.
Here.
Rick Feldstein. Rick Feldstein. Rebecca Fleming.
Here.
Tammy Grimm.
I'm on the phone.
Jose Guillen.
I'm on the phone as well.
Samuel Hamrick.
Here.
Kevin Harrigan.
Here.
Jeffrey Lewis.
Here by phone.
Michael Plant.
Here.
Michael Roddy.
Here.
Brian Taylor.
Here.
Linda Romero Solis.
Here.
Tana Ruben Capal Bianco.
President.
Christina Volkers. Christina Volkers.
She's here.
She's here.
Okay, we'll note her being present. David Yamasaki.
Here.
Okay, so I am told we have an agenda. We have a quorum, but just barely, so don't go home. We've got some work to do. I appreciate, again, everybody's presence, either personally or on the phone. The first item on the agenda after the roll call is the approval of the January 14 minutes. I hope you've all had a chance to peruse those. And do I hear a motion to approve the minutes of the January 14 meeting?
So move.
Planet. So move by Mike Planet. Second.
Roddy.
By Roddy. All have had a chance to consider. All in favor of approving the minutes? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Aye. Any opposed or abstentions? Answer approved. All right. We're ahead of schedule already. I'm going to turn next to Lucy Fogarty to present concerning the LAO's report, and she has some other material she'll be discussing as well. Also, there was some written comment that was received. All those written comments have been distributed to all committee members, so they've had a chance to review those. We do have some folks here today that have asked to make public comment. That will be addressing item on the agenda, item 5. And I've talked to them. It's best on their schedule, and I think for ours, that they present immediately before that item rather than at the beginning of the session. So they will be presenting at that time at 3 minutes speaking each. And with that, Lucy.
So good morning, everybody. What I thought would be a good idea to share with you when we're talking in the context of the LAO report is actually the document we just finalized, which is the budget priorities for the branch that we'll be pursuing through the legislative season this year. And the reason I wanted to provide that as context is because, you know, the LAO report, there were two main recommendations that they made regarding the trial court budgets. The first was regarding the $20 million augmentation, and they cited that there was not a justification for the $20 million because additional dollars were being provided elsewhere for workload. But we all know that we have the WAFM model that clearly shows a funding gap. So we believe that the sufficient justification is provided right there. The second issue they took was with the $30 million innovations fund and that there was not sufficient information provided. Well, you know, that's known, and the whole point is that we're going to be seeking input and from trial courts and appellate courts to determine what kind of innovations should be pursued. There was some more comprehensive budget bill language that more in detail explained the program. But nonetheless, these are the entries in the governor's budget fully supported by the Department of Finance. So as such, that we feel they're going to perform that role to make sure those items stay in the budget, and we feel we better focus our role on seeking additional funds as part of the budget. So that's why I've shared the second document with you, which has identified the four main priorities we're going to be looking at pursuing throughout the legislative process. So as you can see, the first one is to get additional funding over the $20 million for trial court discretionary expenditures. And here we point out again that the WIFM gap is over $400.
Recording has started. This meeting is now being recorded.
The second priority for the branch is going to be funding for 14 new judgeships, including two appellate justices, including funding for a minimal complement of staff. The third item, we are going to continue to pursue dependency council dollars. As you remember, we received $11 million last year. We're looking to seek another $22 million this year. And then the final item is $2.2 million for appellate counsel. So in the governor's budget, there was funding for the panel attorneys, but not for the projects. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with this program. But again, it's a small ask to try and be consistent across the panel attorneys versus the projects that support their panel attorneys. So does anyone have any questions or comments?
You all have the item that was handed out by Lucy. That's, again, sort of the snapshot of our priorities for the year. She's just summarized those. Yep. If anybody have any concerns about anything else? Okay.
Good.
Hearing none. By the way, I'm also told that the announcement of starting the recording was a secondary recording. We've been recording from the beginning, so just so we're all clear. Okay. All right. Moving on to item number two on the agenda, which are the recommendations of the Funding Methodology Subcommittee. I'm at least at the present time, a co-chair of that, along with Rebecca Fleming. I thank Rebecca for all her work, and I think Rebecca and I both would turn to Colin and say, he's the magic behind the business, as usually occurs here. So here you go, magic. It's a new nickname. So I'm going to turn to Colin for his assistance in this presentation. And there are materials attached to this beginning on page 7 of your handouts.
So there are four recommendations that are being presented to the Budget Advisory Committee today from the Funding Methodology Subcommittee. And they are basically dealing with two issues. They're either dealing with updating or clarifying the workload-based allocation funding methodology. There are no significant revisions being made to the workload-based allocation funding methodology. These are merely an update to processes or a clarification of the methodology. As you can see in the report, the council took action in 2013 specifically as related to the WAFM operating expenses and equipment per FTE calculation that's part of WAFM. And you would see that calculation, it's actually in attachment E is the report. And actually, if you want to see the actual calculation, it's in attachment L, which is on pages 28 through 31. And it would actually be on page 29. They made decisions related to that, whether certain expenses would be included or excluded from that calculation. They also identified the inclusion and exclusion of specific fund sources in identifying the equivalent available WAFM funding. So what the Funding Methodology Subcommittee did at this meeting was they came back and they reviewed not only processes for updating the WAFM on an annual basis based on the existing methodology, but they also reviewed whether certain items that are either included or excluded in the WAFM OE&E per FTE methodology needed to be revisited and updated because of items that were excluded or not reviewed or considered at that time. So the four recommendations as they stand are, the first is related to confirming, updating the existing informal update cycles for five WAFM components, and you'll see that those are listed on attachment C on page 11. I'm sorry, it's on attachment B on page 10. And they're the first five items there. So we're basically asking the TICBAC to recommend confirming these informal or informal update cycles, as well as to also set a update schedule annually for the average operating expenses per FTE by cluster component using a three-year average from fourth quarter QFS data, and that would be from the prior through the two fiscal years prior. So this would be consistent with the methodology used for RAS and the BLS update. You can see the rationale and recommendation related to these items on page 8 of the report. And there's also, we provided in attachment C or attachment D, we provided in columns on page 12, columns B and C, we actually provide the calculation of how this would impact the 1516 WAFM ONE per FTE if it were implemented in 1516. It would increase it by between $40.6 million and $65.8 million. Attachment C provides the four options that were presented to the Funding Methodology Subcommittee. They recommended option 1B, which is the second item on attachment C, and you'll see it in parentheticals, it says recommended. And this is the one that is consistent with the RAS and BLS methodology. Related to the other recommendations are related to clarifications of what is and is not included in the ONE per FTE. So this first item, do you want me to go through all four items, or do you want to take them one at a time?
And my thought is we'll go through all four. And then move at the end if anybody, obviously we take questions throughout, but after all that discussion, we'll move for approval of all four as a group, unless we need to break one out.
Okay. So as I mentioned before, the Judicial Council took action related to the items that would be included and excluded back in April of 2013. And that's displayed in attachment E on pages 13 through 17. But when they did that, they actually included and excluded three expenditure items. And so the subcommittee reviewed those items and made recommendations on whether those items should be included or excluded based on other expenses and other categories of expenses that were included and excluded in the current WAFM methodology. And so they actually recommend that the air conditioning, heating equipment expense GL, and the facility planning GLs be excluded, and the grand jury costs be included in the WAFM OENE per FTE calculation. For recommendation three, there were several expense items that were either had no expenses at the time the Judicial Council considered the includable and excludable items in 2013, or had not been created yet. And so these had not been considered previously, and so were by default included in the WAFM ONE per FTE, but we wanted to see if we wanted to clarify that and excluding these items that were by default being included. So the subcommittee reviewed those items, and again, based on the other categories of expenses that were included and excluded currently in the WAFM per FTE, and also consistent with what is considered RAS-related workload, the subcommittee made recommendations on whether those items should be included or excluded. And you'll see that's on attachment F, and those are pages 18 and 19. And last but not least is recommendation 4. And this one's a little bit more complex, but this one is about, but it's simple in concept. And that is that certain items, if they are not included in the WAFM funding sources, should then also not be included in the WAFM, those expenses related to those fund sources should not be included in the WAFM OENE per FTE. And so that is the simple way of describing what the recommendation is for recommendation 4. It is to exclude those expenditures from funds that are considered non-WAFM, non-RAS related fund source expenditures. And you'll see attachments G and H, which provide, and that's on pages 20 through 21 and 22 through 24, specifically attachment H, which provides all the funds sources, and it breaks it up into three categories, either those that are included currently in the RAS workload fund, like the equivalent available funding. The second page is those that are not included in the, are specifically excluded from the equivalent and available funding. And then the third category, which is on page 24, which is those that are, require further review and will be reviewed later for recommendation by the Funding Methodology Subcommittee in 16-17. Attachment I and J provide a summary of what the subcommittee is recommending be included and excluded. And you'll actually see in attachment J, that's the detail. Those are the specific items that are being recommended to be included or excluded from the OANE for FTE, the fund sources that are that should be included and excluded from the OANE per FTE calculation. And it's the very last column of that attachment J. Attachment K provides a calculation showing what the result of this recommendation would be on the OANE per FTE calculation if it were applied in 15-16. And what you'll see is that the OANE per FTE, and say it three times fast, it's very hard, but it would increase from $7.4 million to $29.3 million based on whether or not the TICBAC recommended option 1B or options 2A or 2B. So if it's following the three-year average, it would be the $7 million, which is the recommended. That's the recommendation. It would be $7 million. Or if TICBAC chooses to select another methodology under recommendation one, then it potentially could be an increase of $29.3 million. Are there any questions?
A lot of numbers, a lot of drill down. And thank you, Magic, for doing that. But if anybody has any concerns about that, I know there's many in the room that are very familiar with these numbers as well. Colin's done a great job putting it all together, and thanks to the subcommittee as well. We've met, they've done some work on that. So, any questions? Okay, so what we're going to do is there a motion, as I proposed earlier, rather than take each recommendation 1, 2, 3, and 4 separately, I suggest that the committee consider those as a block, unless somebody wants to break one out or make a different motion. I would invite a motion to approve recommendations 1, 2, 3, and 4 from the workload-based allocation subcommittee.
So moved.
All right. Great. Judge Smith has moved. Any second? Judge Earl has seconded. Any additional comments, questions? All in favor, aye.
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 All right, on the phone as well. So that was both on the phone, just so we're clear. I haven't heard any opposition, so that's any opposition. Hearing none, then recommendations 1, 2, 3, and 4 are approved unanimously by those present. Thank you all very much. Colin, thank you very much, and also for keeping us still ahead of schedule. All right. With that being said, we're now moving to item 3 on the agenda, which is the recommendations of the Ad Hoc Working Group on Fiscal Planning. And Judge Smith?
Yeah. Thank you. So, Magic Holm, if you wouldn't mind just staying a few minutes. He's also magic for our committee as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the history of the work we've done. David Yamasaki, who was kind enough to come on to the Ad Hoc Committee after Mary Beth Todd retired, will talk a little bit about some of the concerns of the courts who are experiencing the stress of technology, projects that are not fully funded. And then Colin will talk about some of the more detailed aspects of the proposal that we're going to be asking for a vote on today. So the ad hoc group was formed in August to develop a proposal to this committee and the council which would allow courts to retain funds in excess of the 1% cap without violating Government Code 77203, with which we are all very familiar.
So I'm starting with the premise that
the Department of Finance's objections was to courts holding funds locally, but that we felt that if the funds were held at the state level, that they would be receptive to a proposal for addressing projects in courts that could not be completed within a single-year budget cycle. So the mission was to come up with a mechanism to accomplish that, And we started with trying to define the categories of uses for any reserves above the 1% that would be held, the amounts, time limitations, how the funds would be held, whether in the trial court trust fund, a new state fund. And then we were talking about application requirements and review and approval processes, and then also reporting responsibilities. And I will just say that the committee was very collaborative. Everybody sort of threw in a lot of ideas, and we did come up with a structure. So there was a consensus that we at first that we wanted a new state fund. So we thought that would protect the funds from getting swept, that they would be held for a distinct purpose. And so we voted in favor of that initially. So we also worked very hard on categories, trying to determine, you know, what categories or projects would fit within the description of something that would be held at the state fund beyond the 1%. Ultimately, we couldn't anticipate all the needs, so we came up that there would be no limitation on the type of project that, but that by clearly articulating the need and why the project didn't fit within the court's annual operating budget process and three-year encumbrance term, and two, a clear timeline for completion and limitation on the times funds would be held, and then again, a transparent reporting process would be sufficient and give the courts the flexibility we thought that they would need. So we talked about that from August till early in the fall, and then there was a lot of conversation, and still is a lot of conversation, in courts where they're facing deadlines for liquidating encumbrances by June 30 of this year, most of which have tech projects that are pending, that are not fully funded. And so it was determined that we really needed a solution sooner rather than later, because we thought we would present something later on in the spring and then perhaps have something by the July 1, and then also because we were talking about a new fund, that it would sort of take the entire legislative process to do that. But we also felt that at that point we'd get Zlatko involved, because we wanted him to give us some feedback on our ideas, our timeline, sort of where we were going with the proposal. And that was good for two reasons, because I think he had his finger on the pulse of not only the political process that would be necessary for getting this done, but also what the chatter he was hearing from courts, that we need a solution right now because we've got a lot of pressing projects and there are a lot of courts who need relief now. So we accelerated the timeline and for just presenting a proposal. We first thought it would be just for the pressing tech projects, and that we would then expand perhaps to include other kinds of projects, but ultimately it was just more efficient to come up with a single process we thought would not only address the current needs, but also more long-term needs, or at least a breadth of projects that weren't being addressed immediately. So also Zlatko was kind of a reality check. He said that a new fund would not work because it was just too politically expensive, that the process of getting something through the legislature would not only be hard, but then we would lose control because the legislature was involved. And then holding it at the trial court trust fund level was really what we needed to do, work within the structure that we already had. So we agreed on that, and we also have come up with essentially the document that is attached to item number 3. And I want to pass it on to David to talk a little bit about some of the projects that are and some of the needs that are most pressing and kind of what's pushing this agenda. But before I do that, I just want to say thank you to Colin, who sort of kept us on time and on task and put together a number of documents that helped us really navigate this kind of murky water. He always does. But he was pretty phenomenal, and he even came back from Iceland in time enough to be here today. So thank you, Colin. Thank you, Zlatko. And Zlatko's, I think, slaying some dragons in Sacramento today and couldn't be on the call, but he was very helpful, too, just kind of keeping us focused on the prize and sort of how to get there with most political efficiency and then with the best benefits to our courts.
Thank you, Judge Smith. And if I can just add to Colin, not only is he magic, he may be Steph Curry, too. Some of you might know who he is. I can't overstate enough the scenarios that were examined to try to put together this particular proposal. And we were thinking back of some of the variables that we were trying to recognize, some of those variables coming from the former director of the Department of Finance, but also the new director, then new director, Michael Cohen, of recognizing some of the reasons for placing this limitation on how much courts could maintained locally in their fund balance. So what we recall in the conversation that we had with him in the Judicial Council, one of the things that he was very clear on is that there was a need to retain some resources for courts, but the placement as to where those resources were held, he was very insistent that they be overseen by the Judicial Council. And this, in fact, is consistent with that recommendation and, really recognizing some of the concerns that they raised early on about having the resources kept locally. And so that was one of the reasons why it was very critical for us to continue dialoguing with the Department of Finance through SLOTCO in making sure that they are very comfortable with the proposals and the steps that we're trying to take to address very significant concerns that we have locally, particularly, as Judge Smith had mentioned, with the fact that we have to liquidate some of these encumbrances at the end of this year, and many of us facing deployments of technology that we're not going to be finished by the end of this year. So we would potentially be faced with paying for something before delivery, which is not something that we should ever do, in my view. At any rate, the proposal that we have not only addresses the immediate concerns where courts are going to have some relief, but also builds in a process going forward so that courts who would like to save money for very key capital projects that would otherwise be capped at the 1% level can actually save some money for specific programs that may not come to fruition this year or next year, but down the road, because we simply don't have the liquidity or the available assets to just simply purchase a expensive item in one fiscal year. So this builds in a process for us to build budgets for technology, for any capital expense that we have to be prepared for. So before you are three recommendations, and I'm going to have ask that Colin provide a little bit more detail. But the first one on page 34 identifies a process for the trial court trust fund to retain some funds for each court locally for specific areas. Another, the second item relates to some of the things that we believe are critical to make them even eligible for saving the money. To just have a speculative concept of what you'd like to save money for, I think creates a bit of an issue in the perception of the executive branch, and we obviously want to make sure that everybody understands what the motives are, what the money is that we are trying to save, and make sure that it's aligned with what the actual expense would be. And then the third one is the type of information that we're recommending be forwarded to the Judicial Council for their consideration in ensuring that the motives and purposes are clearly detailed and gives us a duty, if you to make sure that those monies are spent for those precise purposes. Part of that obviously is a recognition that there will be an audit process to make sure that those monies were spent for those intended purposes, but also an opportunity to maybe adjust should needs change going forward that may be different from the original purpose of saving those monies. So great support from all of the members of the subcommittee, and I think that paves a good opportunity for us to start saving some money for very real needs that all of the trial courts have going forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to Colin.
First off, I'd like to say that I'm more of a team statistician than a player. I supported a great team, so I was happy, and two great co-chairs, the likes of which Pat Riley and Steve Kerr have never seen, so it was great. So Pat Riley, showtime. Anyway, there are three recommendations, and they're all on Attachment A, and basically they cover three different areas. The first is process, the second is criteria, which is actually covered in the process. The first item under process, it actually identifies the criteria. And then the third item is the recommended information, which we actually, basically it's the information that they would provide in the application. And you can, instead of thinking about how that's going to be abstract, instead of thinking about it abstractly, you'll actually be able to see it in attachment two. That's the application. So that required information, how it would be displayed is the attachment B, the application for TCTF funds held on behalf of the courts. So I just want to quickly focus on the process and just make you aware of the things that the working group considered. These are the main areas that the working group considered in identifying what is important related to this process of holding money on behalf of the courts at the state fund level. So they looked at criteria, which is the first item. The second item was they looked at the submission review and approval process. And that submission review and approval process would be, currently it would be submitted to the Judicial Council for consideration going to the Administrative Director. And then it would, JCC Finance Budget staff would review the submission for completeness, and then they would generate a report for a TICBAC subgroup who would then make a recommendation that would go directly to the Judicial Council. The third area that they reviewed was the submission deadline. What's an appropriate amount of time necessary to allow staff to review, complete a report, then have a subgroup, then review it, and then make a recommendation to the Judicial Council in time. And so currently, that recommendation is 40 business days, okay? The fourth item is just allowing for additional terms and conditions where the Judicial Council feels it's appropriate. The fifth item there, it discusses amended requests. When an amended request would need to be submitted by a requesting court. What are the criteria for submitting new information? And so the current threshold is when there are change in the planned annual expenditures or encumbrances, the total amount of the planned expenditures, or a change of more than 10% of the total request among the categories of expense. The sixth item is just talking about change in purpose and basically requiring the requesting court that if they have a change in purpose, and that may need to be further defined, but currently it is stated that if there is a change in purpose that they will need to submit a new request. There's also under G, that is a reporting requirement. So after the fact, after the planned expenditure or project is completed, the court would need to report to the TICBAC within 90 days on that project and how the funds are expended. And the final item related to this whole structure is related to audit review. That as part of the regular audit cycle, the courts would any expenditures that were related to funds that were held on their behalf would be reviewed to confirm that they were used for the stated approved purpose. There's not much else there. I'm not going to go into the detail related to the required recommended information. This is in some ways similar to what's been provided for supplemental funding, but they did feel that there is unique information that needs to be provided that wouldn't apply to the supplemental funding. But this is consistent in some ways with the information that's been asked, of course, related to supplemental funding, with additional information that's being required because of this being a multi-year project, and it's related to planning purposes and use of those monies. So if there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Questions at all for Stephen? Chris, did you have a question?
Do, and I'm on the subcommittee. I just want to ask a clarifying question so everybody understands.
Sure.
Under combined 35, page 35, B4, I think I just want clarification. It will not, the request will never come back to this to seek the budget advisory. It'll just go to the subcommittee, then to the council, right? Or
that's
the
right.
Work group or whatever you want yourselves.
Right, the whatever subgroup that TICBAC decides to form. You know, whether it's the working group that continues under a new name, because right now it has a limited lifespan, or some other group, but it would just go immediately from that group to the Judicial Council.
Thank you.
Dr. Earl?
I have a question, Colin. This is for a three-year period that the money would be retained at the in the trial court trust fund?
No, it's not set for 3 years. There, right? Currently, there isn't a time time limit or set for that because it was felt that it was arbitrary because of courts may need multiple years to just to contribute into the fund to have those monies held before they could be expended. And so they felt that it would be difficult to set that timeline. So one wasn't set. It's not that one, they may come back and change that, but currently they felt that would be difficult to kind of set that maybe arbitrary.
Is there a maximum amount that can be rolled into the trust fund?
No limits currently set.
And let me just add to that. We talked about that at length in the committee because we started out with specific categories and a specific time and you know, searching for the right amount of money we thought would be a fair limitation. But there's, you know, the needs of the courts are so varied that, you know, you may have a really big project in a big county where you're going to need to save money for a long time. And we thought that if the application process and the criteria for applying was specific enough to say exactly what is your project, why doesn't it fit within the budget process, why do you need to hold on, have this money held for the projected amount of time, that would be enough of a check and balance and transparent enough for it to be acceptable to Department of Finance, that we wouldn't get blowback about it being just sort of a slush fund.
So what mechanism is in place if a court gets approval to put money into the trust fund for a specific project,
mm-hmm.
and they indicate that the project is likely to need the money, say, in 3 or 5 years? What mechanism is in place to make sure that after 3 to 5 years they have spent that money the way that they have said they needed to save it for?
I can answer that. I think the mechanism is validation or verification that the monies were spent for that purpose. You can't save the money and then decide for let's say a new case management system, and then just turn around and spend it on, you know, a fleet of vehicles. So there has to be a mechanism in place to demonstrate that you spent the money for that purpose. And I'll use the challenge that we have with placing a duration is, as an example, case management systems. They can cost, let's say, $5 million, and many courts have been saving some monies for the purpose of acquiring a new case management system, but they may not necessarily be able to save $1 million or $2 million. Maybe it's a few hundred thousand. It's going to take time to build resources for that type of a project. So obviously recognizing the importance of spending the money as specified early on, the fact that many of us don't have discretionary funding to put into that pot in big numbers, but there could be a year that money can be excelled in terms of being able to put money aside. So really, if a court needs more time, they have the time to save the money. If their needs change, then there's a process in place to enable them to change the need. But I obviously recognize the danger that we have in having a fund build for a number of years. Quite honestly, I think our needs are so great that we'll be seeing the money spent as soon as possible rather than, you know, seeing an accumulation build in larger numbers.
So I agree with you. I don't think we'll reach the situation where a court puts money in and then doesn't spend it and puts more money in and doesn't spend it, because the fear is we get to the point what the legislature and the governor were so critical of, that fund balances accumulated to these levels, clearly the governor and legislature didn't agree with that. So maybe it's a problem that will never arise, but that is a concern that this goes to a period of time without, and these fund balances once again grow, but they're at the state level as opposed to the local level.
So on that, was there a discussion about whether or not courts could have more than one request? I would assume they'd be limited to one request.
No, there are numbers of requests. I'll use Santa Clara as an example. We had to acquire a new case management system. We also had to save money for the move to our new courthouse, which is several hundred thousand dollars. There are things that we just a new phone system that we have to put into this new courthouse, and the needs of all the courts are varied depending on where they happen to be building a new courthouse or needing a new case management system. But clearly, if we had this opportunity, we would have earmarked it. We would have shown the expenditure of it. And so I don't think we're going to be seeing large pots of money that will necessarily be a challenge for us.
And wouldn't it be transferable between projects? So I agree with your concept. So maybe you have three different projects, and one of them falls away for another reason. Those funds would not be available for projects one and two?
Not without approval by the Judicial Council. It would have to be overseen by that entity. And let's say, for example, a court saved money for an engagement management system, and a local county says, hey, we really would like to help you, and we'd like to provide that case management system for you. That would then free up that money, and if a court wanted to use it for something else, they'd have to petition the council. If they can't, well, guess what? Then it falls back into the trial court trust fund, let's say, under the provisions that are built into the 1% cap. If it's not spent, you have more than 1%, it goes back. So, again, we don't want to... We didn't want to create a situation to skirt the restrictions that we have right now, and we wanted to be true to what we're trying to do, and that is prepare opportunities for us to acquire systems or pay for big expenses through this this mechanism.
Linda, did you have I want to pause for a moment and acknowledge that Mary Beth Todd, as you all know, is she actually retired? And in her place is Linda Romero Solis from Merced County. I don't think you've been with us before, so welcome. Thank you so much. And you had a question.
Yes. Besides the technology and facilities and infrastructure projects, what were some of the examples that the committee discussed regarding court efficiency projects?
I can answer that. Some capital projects, technology maintenance and repair not covered by Judicial Council, some facilities and efficiencies. So, you may have a project that's going to create an efficiency in the court that's going to cost you a certain amount of money to put that in place, but it's not currently budgeted. Capital projects, you need a fleet of cars, that kind of thing. We just sort of threw a number of ideas out there because we were trying to really identify categories at first, thinking that might be a good way for, put a check and balance on the process, that there were just certain kinds of things. But we just decided that you don't know what you don't know, that sort of doing that might be somewhat self-defeating, and that if we were to put other kinds of restrictions, that is to say, you needed to identify very specifically what it is, the amount of time within which you were going to expend the funds, and that would be checked and audited annually, and at the state level, so it's transparent. Anybody can see these public documents that would be generated by any audit or review, that would be enough, and that courts weren't going to be looking for the opportunity to violate the rule. They're going to be looking for the opportunity to really help the court acquire whatever they need to acquire. So I understand the concerns, but I think as soon as you limit the categories within which you can apply for certain kinds of projects, there's certain to be that project that's not in the category that's just as necessary as the one that's in the categories. And then in a way, you're not really accomplishing. We wouldn't be accomplishing what we wanted to accomplish.
Judge Herman?
Yeah, just a comment and a question. The comment is this is really timely because we've got 30-plus courts that are either in deployment or in contract in terms of case management systems. And I think some courts are finding out now that, there's a two-year encumbrance limit, and so you can encumber, but that encumber evaporates. And if you're... go live extends beyond the 2 years. This is an important backfill. The question I have is on the construction project side. Is this an opportunity, given that that's a capital expense, where there's an over budget construction project to fill that gap?
We didn't talk about that, but I would imagine not, because if you have a construction project that's already in process, then that's not a project that you would start a fund for. That's a project you'd have to sort of figure out what you need to do to fill that gap. I think because once you know that there's a problem, then I don't know how you save money going forward to fill a gap that already exists. It's probably a project that's going to have to be resolved before you have an opportunity to identify the problem, build the funds, and then pay it off. I don't know if that's possible, but we didn't talk about construction projects.
I just know that it's another issue that a number of courts are facing where there were budget projections, and then as the project progresses, there's an overage, and we know that the 1407 fund is in deficit balance at this point, so mm-hmm. it's difficult to backfill or to deal with budget overages.
I can't say we were thinking quite that large, that big. I think we were, thinking much more of discrete projects, sort of with a beginning and an end, and that what could be projected so that you could say between, 2017 and 2020, we're trying to accomplish X, and that's what we're saving money for. We anticipate X is going to cost, $1.2 million, that we can save that money, and that by 2019, it'll be expended and done. And maybe if you get to 2019, then it's going to spill over into a little bit of 2020, then you augment the request to say, but it's going to be done. There is a point, though, we anticipated that if it just kind of goes on, then it will revert back to the trial court trust fund, that it's not something that just can go on forever.
Yeah, and, courts may find themselves not being able to accumulate enough savings to execute a project or implement a project, but it gives courts an opportunity. Again, I don't think we're going to have significant fund balances in these particular line items. But it helps us get us started and perhaps backfill it with whatever surpluses we may realize in our local budgets. But right now there is no option available for us to save money for big projects that I assure you we will have big projects well into the future that are not going to be necessarily funded separately. So we need this tool. We've certainly had a lot of support from the Department of Finance with the concept, they're recognizing the need, just like other entities in state government, that we have to save money for things that we either expect or don't expect.
Judge Earl?
So I don't want it to be misunderstood. I fully support the use of the fund. In fact, these discussions started last August, so I don't want that to be misunderstood. But I want to make my concern is it's not tight enough, and that Department of Finance has an objection to it, and that's why I keep coming back to this question that I have is whether or not Judge Young, you or anyone on your committee mm-hmm. considered including on the application a date by which the court thought it was going to expend the funds.
Oh yeah,
and if they didn't, a process by which maybe they had to come back to the council or to your subcommittee with an update on this is why the funds aren't going to be expended by X date, but we anticipate that they will by this date. Whether you had a discussion about that, including that in the process, maybe I've overlooked it. But also you, I don't mean to make this a compound question. You also, I heard you say that it won't just roll over forever. At some point it'll revert to the child court trust fund if it's not expended. At what point would that be?
Let's see. Do you want me to speak to that?
Yeah,
sure. Okay. So there are a few different things. So as part of the application, so here, I think you're talking about kind of controls. Like what controls do we have in place? And so part of the initial controls are in the application itself. They require a schedule of the specific funding and expenditures. So one of the things that you're asking for is please provide us each year how much of those funds you're going to expend and also by category and amount. So that's the front end. Then, as relates to if your schedule changes, say your schedule changes, say you need over 5 years, this is what your schedule is, under the amended request, if your schedule changes, you need to immediately submit an amended request to the Judicial Council stating, okay, our schedule's changed and this is what it is, please approve it. And if the council does not approve it, the money's immediately revert to not being held on behalf of the court. So that was considered and included, actually, as part of the process. And then beyond that, there's the reporting requirement and also the audit process. So even if the court, unfortunately, doesn't communicate accurately what it's doing, the audit process after the fact would then catch that and say, no, you did not spend these monies for the state approved purpose that was approved. So those are the controls that are in place to make sure. So basically, if... as it relates to this timeline, it would depend on each project. So if the project were 3 years and something happened or did not happen in the timeline it was supposed to, then the Judicial Council could act and say, this is not consistent with your schedule. These monies revert to the Trial Court Trust Fund.
And I would add that, and David, you can chime in on this, when we talked to Zlatko, because we specifically came to him and said, okay, this is kind of a general outline of what we want to do, and he agreed to go and talk with finance and sort of and let them know what we were doing, kind of where we were going, and what our plan was. And my recollection is that he came back with, they think this is fine, and that they were not concerned about the specificity of the purpose, or so that there were not categories. I think it was more concerned that, A, they were holding it at the state level, and that there was a tight process for auditing, for applying, and I think there was even a sense that, no, we don't want to get involved in it. Judicial Council can handle this. But, you know, sort of thank you very much for letting us know this is what you're doing, because that's what you do need to do that, but that we don't want a part of it. We don't want to be a part of it, because we even talked about perhaps finance being involved in the process, but they weren't interested in it. But I think that they were receptive to the idea, and that they were not worried about the kind of particulars of it so much as that there were controls, that there were limitations, and then it would be managed by the Judicial Council, and closely so. But David, you can...
Yeah, and I would say that the level of checks and balances that have been built in were not mandated by the Department of Finance. But obviously, we know where we're sitting. We know some of the concerns that they've had, and we've built those mechanisms in. So this is not a runaway account. It clearly requires courts to identify what they're going to use that money for. And if they don't, then obviously the Judicial Council has an opportunity to intercede. But I think it's pretty tight from my estimation, and I think it's well within the expectations that, that were communicated to us by DOF. So I think we're in pretty good shape.
Judge Kaufman?
Yeah, I like what you're doing. I think it's a great idea, because when they took the when we went to 1%, that has killed a lot of projects and caused us an inability to plan. What concerns me is that 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, all of a sudden we have this fund that has millions of dollars in there. We hit a recession, and the legislature says, hey, guys, you got $100 million sitting there. Take it. Okay? Also is that I don't want to be later on everybody. We just start putting money. We stash money there for projects or whatever, and the DOF says, no, that's not a great idea. We're going to take it. I think there has to be some we have to administer it very tightly. And I think we have to have some idea of what a maximum is. You just can't keep putting money there and let it grow and let the fund grow, and all of a sudden the legislature wants to you know, take it.
And I couldn't agree with you more of the risk that we have, Judge Kaufman. But as Colin was indicating, we can't just dream up numbers and say we're going to do that. There has to be some basis for that. If we were to say you need to implement a case management within 2 years, guess what? Many of us now realize that's just too short. So many of us now realize actually what we've been saving for to implement a new case management system doesn't account for so many other changes that we are now realizing. So without the tool to save money right now for these types of activities, we cannot move forward.
No, I agree with you. The question is, are we going to be allowed to make sure that we're allowed to keep this money and it doesn't get swept, or you know, that's what worries me more than anything else.
Well, you know what? We talked about that, and actually Zlatko was pretty realistic. He said, you know, they swing money anytime, and they might do that. So there's no guarantee the money will never get swept, and they can sweep money anyway. Whether it's that fund or some other fund, there's a real, you know, there's always a danger of that in a recession. So I don't think that we can anticipate this. I don't think there's anything we can do about that. I don't think that should prevent us from doing what we're doing. And that's also, it's, you know, it can be certainly a living thing. And that if we find that there are issues, then changes can be made. If they find that, you know, that there needed tighter restrictions or a limitation of some sort, then I think that can be addressed. I don't think that we're anticipating that everything we're doing now is cast in stone and it will never change. There are maybe all kinds of circumstances that cause the council to reconsider this or change it or modify it. So I think we just have to go forward and just sort of see what happens. But I think that given the press of business for lots of courts that do have encumbrances that have to be dealt with by June 30th, I think that we thought this is the best way to approach it. Let's go forward with it. If not modifications need to be made going forward, we'll do that.
And Judge Kaufman, I think Judge Kaufman's point is a good one, but as concerning the I think there's such specific guidelines on this money that rather than it be viewed as a slush fund, if the Department of Finance were to come back and look at it, I think the appropriate argument could be made that these are funds that have been pre-designated for projects rather than courts just stashing money somewhere.
Well, and they were on board with this. They know about this, and so that's why we went to them first to say this is what we are going to do. And they know this is happening. They know why it's happening. And so I can't imagine that later on it's like this is a slush fund.
Sure.
Because it is very tightly controlled. I mean, who knows what the next governor will say if there's another governor or someone else in finance.
Right. If we hit a recession, any dollars we have, they're going to take. They've done it in the past, and they'll do it again.
You're right. And I think we all know that. You're right. And it's just a risk we take. Mike Planet, did you have a question?
So I did a question and a comment. A question, if I read D1, let's say the court changes its mind or something happens, and the money that was put in this fund, the reason changed. Do I read this to say that the money goes back to the court, becomes undesignated, goes back to the court, and it's the court's problem to deal with it if it's puts them over the 1%, another risk associated with putting this in, or does it once it goes to the trust fund it stays there?
Stays there. So when the funds are distributed. Like for a project, that would be the only time the court would see the funds is during the case of an approved project or planned expenditure. Each year the judicial council would allocate that portion of the money that the court needed for that year. But other than that, the money would stay at the trial court trust fund. If they, under D1, that failure to comply, that just means that those monies are no longer designated for that court. They're just trial court trust fund monies.
Second, I want to say I fully support this. I think it addresses one of the unintended consequences of the 1% cap is where we find ourselves rushing up towards the end of the year, making expenditures for things that I might not be a priority, but for the fact that the penalty of ending up the year over the 1%. So I think it's a great proposal, and I would move its approval.
All right. So I just had one. And so there's a motion.
Second.
A second from... Judge Kaufman,
who is this? Question.
Okay, hold on. Okay, Judge Herman seconded, so we got the motion pending, but now there's a question from Judge Kaufman.
The only thing is that, and I'm going to vote for it, so don't take it wrong, but basically what we're doing is we're doing a workaround against having ability to save money over periods of time. Is it right?
And I wouldn't phrase it as a workaround. It really is a tool. The 1% cap there was a law of unintended consequences.
Right.
We can't save for big ticket items that we have. So this is an opportunity for us to demonstrate that there are needs that courts have that we can save for have really stifled our ability to grow right now. So I would look at it as a opportunity tool to help us go forward.
But also, there are a lot of courts who can't put money away because they don't have. They're not
absolutely.
So it's a workaround in the sense that we still have to work for more money and all that. And you're smiling at me. You and I have had this discussion for many years. But to me, it's a temporary solution and as opposed to a long term solution.
So you're right. Maybe
no
more than a workaround. It's a solution.
Yeah.
All right. I'm sorry, Judge Sanders.
I was just going to say there's a strong disincentive not to. Put money aside pursuant to this proposal, because if the court then doesn't use it for the project, they forfeit the money. So it's unlikely in the first place that people are going to have money to put into the fund, and secondly that they're going to do it to try and create some sort of slush fund for themselves because they need to use it for the designated project absent further permission from the council.
Good point. So on the same, was there a discussion, it might be apples and oranges, but the 2%, and which is now going to be the $10 million. We'll talk about that this afternoon. But let's assume a court has worked diligently. They've put aside whatever money it is in the 1%, and then they suffer an unforeseen crisis. Their case management system gets hacked, and they lose everything. I assume these two are mutually exclusive, so somebody could not come to them and say, well, you can't come from the 2% because you've done such a good job in the 1%, right?
That was not considered. Those are considered mutually exclusive issues, and we didn't dive into that.
As long as I think that's a correct concept. And I'm sorry, did I see a hand?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Judge. Just in these discussions that you had with the Department of Finance and others, did it ever come up that maybe the 1% limit for reserve should be reconsidered?
Well, no, not that I know of. Just I think Slatko was talking specifically about this project. But I do want to say that in developing this proposal, we wanted to be clear we were not didn't want to undermine advocacy efforts to change the 1% rule. And it wasn't, we didn't think that that would happen because we were trying to address an immediate problem and actually became even more immediate because of these projects. But we definitely didn't want to undermine the advocacy efforts to change the 1%. And I don't think it would be perceived this way. I think it's really a solution to a problem that we are experiencing now, and that long term, you know, we would like to reconsider the 1%. And I don't think this is like throwing in the towel and saying, okay, well, we're sanguine with the 1%, so this is our solution. This is a solution to a kind of a different problem, and that we would like to change the 1%. So we don't need this, so that perhaps we can abandon this and then, you know, come up with a something else, perhaps just abandoning the 1% so that we can save money again.
Thank you. All right, any other questions? I'm sorry, Joe Sherman.
Just one, and you know, it was the legislature that swept $1.8 billion out of our construction fund. So I'm just wondering what visibility this is going to have at the legislative level, particularly given the LAO, which seems to periodically be up to mischief as far as our funding is concerned, including the most recent $30 million, $20 million construction fund criticisms. So are we keeping a low profile relative to the legislature? Are we wiring legislative support? I mean, it's pretty much internal. It would pretty much be internal in discussions with DOF at this point.
David?
I would only say this. $1.8 billion is significantly more than I anticipate seeing in this particular account. So, or these accounts. So I, you know, as has been stated, obviously the legislature can do whatever they choose. But on the other hand, if we have agreements tied up for the use of that money, how can they take that money? And that's specifically the requirement and to save it, to buy a new case management system. You don't sign an agreement necessarily when it has to be spent. You sign an agreement in advance of that. So I think this is a risk that's worthy of taking.
Any other questions, comments, or concerns? So the current motion, I just want to make sure we're all clear on this. The recommendations are set forth on combined page 34. It's recommendations 1 through 3. And I believe the current motion is to accept or adopt those recommendations as stated without any changes. And I can read them, but I believe you all have them.
Call the question.
Okay, the question is that Stephen has is the 10% language at the end of recommendation number one. It says it's not recommending a specific threshold, the 10% being a placeholder for discussion. So the concept is that that number is there as a concept, a number rather than a limiting number?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Hearing no further questions and the motion's been seconded, call the question. All in favor of adopting recommendations 1 through 3, the exact language stated on combined page 34, say aye.
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 All right. And here, any opposed, nay? Hearing none, then the recommendations have passed on page 34. Recommendations 1 through 3 have been adopted unanimously. Okay. There's a quick announcement here. I know we're now back on schedule, but they want to make a shuttle announcement. Magic, thank you very much.
Is everybody who needs to signed up for the shuttle?
It'll come around.
Okay.
Great. We are now back on timely track, so now we're moving to item 4, the recommendations of the Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee, and I invite, therefore, Judge Earl and Sherry Carter to present on this issue.
And I actually think we were going to ask Mark to do this, right? Judge Earl?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
I think, but...
Mark.
Oh, okay.
There, okay.
I can set the stage if you want.
Okay, Judge Earl, thank you. Setting the stage, Judge Earl.
So we have a significant increased cost in the land WAN program next year. So the Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee, along with reviewing other items funded from the Trust Fund and the IMF, looked at what solutions what options would be utilized for solutions to the increase in land WAN expenditures. And we talked about a number of them. Ultimately, we landed on a recommendation that to address the shortfall, that the money be spent to either lease or finance equipment so that all of the projects that need to go forward could continue to go forward and any of the refresh cycles could continue to be met. But I will now turn it over for the details.
Can I just say one other
yes.
thing? I think our charge, too, was to ask the Judicial Council staff to find a way to level the cost from year to year, because it was really the spikes that created the problem for the IMF fund. And so I think that's what we're going to hear about today, is the leveling, right?
Yes.
Okay. And I'll just so everybody's aware, and this is probably stating the obvious, but the work that's gone into this by this subcommittee has been more than significant as far as drilling down and working on the numbers, so it is much appreciated. Sorry for the interruption. Go ahead.
No worries. Good morning. I'm Michael Durr with the Judicial Council IT Division. Today I'd like to provide a summary on the information that has been reviewed with the Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee over the past several months. And I'd also like to provide a basis for the recommendation to move forward with Option 3. To recap, the telecom program is projecting a large spike in expenses for the fiscal year 16-17. And this is the result of hardware that will reach the end of its service life and will be due for refresh. At the outset, expenditures were forecast at $35 million for the fiscal year, which significantly exceeded the available budget. Working with the court IT managers, we reviewed options to close the budget gap and an option to adopt a managed service model for the court firewalls was identified. This allowed us to reduce the fiscal year 16-17 expenditures by approximately $6.2 million. This option also establishes a flat year-over-year spending pattern for that budget component moving forward. And as of February, this had closed the budget gap to approximately $6.3 million. And in collaboration with the court IT managers, we reviewed three different options to address that deficit. The first option was to identify a way to fully fund the program, and this is not realistic in the short term, but ideally would entail the establishment of stable, ongoing funding for the program. The second option was to defer the replacement of hardware past the end of its service life, and there was a universal opposition to this option because of the impact to network stability and to security. The third option was to employ the use of financing to address the short-term budget shortfall, and this is the option that was recommended and is the subject of discussion today. In reviewing these options, questions came up as to the exact nature of financing that would be involved. The term lease financing was used initially. And in a more detailed review, we worked to establish better detail and clarity with the options. The outcome was that lease financing is better described as a lease purchase arrangement where equipment is leased and the branch has the option to take title of the equipment for $1 at the end of the term. This differs from a traditional lease where the equipment with some amount of residual value is turned in at the end of the lease. Another outcome was the review of a traditional finance option where the branch takes title to the equipment up front. And to help evaluate the options, the California Department of General Services was engaged. And they have a group that is specifically focused on both leasing and financing arrangements. A review of the factors that they recommended to consider is shown in slide 6 of the presentation that was distributed for this meeting. And the conclusion that was presented in the February meeting was that financing was the more appropriate of the two options, in that it would be more suited to our specific circumstance, as well as slightly cheaper and less complex. It's important to note that this analysis assumed the financing of $9.7 million over a three-year term. And that's the model that allowed us to achieve the flattest long-term budget. Also, there's a chart that provides a visual comparison of the three scenarios included on slide 11 of the presentation, included with your materials, and option three is shown in green. Wrapping up our review, we also looked at how to avoid budget spikes such as this moving forward. Our findings were that while a one-time use of financing in fiscal year 16-17 would address the issue for 6 to 7 years, another spike would occur when equipment comes due for refresh down the road. And we determined that this could be handled in one or a combination of three ways. First, we could use the financing option again at that juncture. Second, we could explore the migration of additional infrastructure to a managed service model where we subscribe to the equipment as opposed to purchasing it outright. And that would be as deemed appropriate and in the court's best interest before deciding to move forward in that direction. And the third option would be to phase the future refresh of equipment over multiple years, which would entail the refreshing of some of the equipment early. The caveat with the third option is that we may find that it's cheaper overall to incur finance charges than it is to amortize the hardware costs over a shorter period of time and walk away from it while there's still some residual value with it. Another caveat with all the options is that this is not something that we can set and forget. The program needs to actively focus each and every fiscal year on how our established plan of action impacts subsequent budget years. In summary, based on the analysis that we performed, the recommendation provided to the Revenue and Expenditure Subcommittee in February was to employ the use of financing on a periodic basis. At this point, I'd like to turn the discussion back over for discussion and any questions.
Treasurer?
Well, I was looking at the recommendation that is listed on combined page 85 of your materials. And the recommendation is just for the next fiscal year only to address the goal of replacing equipment on schedule by either financing or the purchase of some equipment with the option of lease finance to be determined by the Judicial Council. We did not feel it was really our job to make that decision of whether or not it should be by lease or purchase, that was more of a policy decision. But I think on further reflection, I had a conversation with Sherry this morning. She and I are the co-chairs of this subcommittee. I think the intent was that really it should be the Judicial Council's administrative director who makes that decision. It seems to be more of an administrative decision, but I'll let Sherry weigh in on that.
No, I think that's right. It was, in fact, my motion that, and what I thought I had stated is it would be determined by the administrative director. It really is a business decision, and I think that would fall within his purview to make the decision on whether it's leasing or finance. So I would recommend that the recommendation on page 85 strike by Judicial Council, and it would be by the administrative director.
So I'd agree with that.
So it's a comma with the option of lease versus finance as determined by the administrative director?
Yes. Yeah. Right. That would be my recommendation.
Okay, so that's not an amendment. That's the motion itself.
Right. Yes.
That's a suggestion.
I would be happy to turn that into a motion with that change.
All right. It was a leading question on my behalf. I apologize. But Sherry Carter has now made the motion. The recommendation on combined page 85, recommendation 1, as reading after the comma with the option of lease versus finance as determined by the administrator.
Judge, I second that motion.
All right, seconded by Mr. Yamasaki. Any questions, concerns? I know this is an issue that a lot of work has gone into and obviously still to come. Questions, concerns, anything? I'm going to call the question. All right, it's been moved and seconded that the recommendation on combined page 85, number 1, as change this morning. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? All right.
I have one question, additional issue. We originally talked about sending this to the Judicial Council Technology Committee. Is this going to go through the council at all, Sherry, or is there the thrust of the motion that it would simply be a recommendation to JCC staff? What's the process?
You know, I assume that it would follow the same process that Mr. Hoshino follows for whatever decisions he made. I know that it is going, I'm pretty sure it was going to be reviewed by the tech committee, but whether the cost-benefit analysis is one way or another is really, I think, up to the administrative director.
Right. So, Jill, just so it's clear, I've had conversations with now Justice Slough, and the concept is that their JCTC will be working with tech concerning, and I'm oversimplifying this, but concerning the mechanics,
right.
Concerning switches, everything to buy, that our recommendation is, as stated, concerning now that we know what we're going to get, here's the pot of money, and now it's up to Mr. Hoshino and staff to decide how to use that pot of money to most appropriately appropriate that equipment.
Totally agree with that concept.
Okay.
So will our recommendation go to the Judicial Council for approval?
Yes, it will not go. You're right. It's not going through JCTC. It's going to the council.
Correct.
Yes.
Why would it not go through JCTC? Just as a matter of,
I think it is a courtesy.
It sure will.
But budget side of it would be our separate recommendation.
So we're not. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We are advising them of our recommendation. But our recommendation doesn't go to them, then to the council. Our recommendation goes to the council. But Justice Slough is aware of this. I was talking to Judge Earl and Sherry throughout the weekend, and this language was contemplated. And my understanding is she even volunteered to be on the phone call if necessary. But I don't think I'm speaking out of turn by saying that's how she anticipated it would proceed.
Right.
So there is now, I've asked for, right, it's been votes been taken, no opposition. Recommendation is adopted. Okay, great. We're right on schedule. We're now moving to the next item on the agenda, which is item 5. The recommendations of the court-appointed council funding allocation methodology joint subcommittee. And before we do that, we do have initially, we had three public speakers. Another speaker came in, was understandably delayed, and just so Ms. Cruz is aware, Ms. Cruz, we're going to allow you to speak, so that's fine. If there's any question, there's four speakers. Considering our rather tight schedule, however, and to be respectful of all speakers so everybody has time, I'm going to ask you to keep your comments to 3 minutes, and without being rude, I'll give you a little bit of notice as you get close to 3 minutes. Oh, and all right, there's a fifth one as well. I'm going to show the same courtesy. Again, just I want to make sure everybody's a chance to be heard on this. We'll keep those comments to 3 minutes each. So Ms. Goodman as well will be added in as a fifth speaker, but that closes the speakers list. If somebody comes in now, they can submit a public comment. I guess not. Anyway, so that being said, I'll invite Candy Mays to speak, please. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Candy Mays, and I'm the Executive Director of the Dependency Legal Group of San Diego. I'm here specifically to address Recommendation 10 of Item Number 5. I'd like to thank the Methodology Work Group Committee for everything that they've done so far on this issue. There's a lot of work that needed to be done because this hasn't been looked at since 2004, I believe. So definitely a lot of data that needed to be compiled, and so I wanted to thank them personally, as well as on behalf of many of the advocates here in California, for all of the hard work that they've done and as far as they've gotten so far. I'm here to specifically ask this committee to address the reallocation budget plan that you adopted last year. I'm asking you to freeze that plan at the year one levels rather than go forward with the year two budget levels that are currently planned for in that. I'm not asking for a restoration of any of the money that has been taken from any of the so-called donor counties. I'm just asking that no additional money be taken from us as contemplated by the current plan in light of the information that the methodology work group already knows and what we anticipate them continuing to do in their ongoing work. I was here last year. Many of us advocates were talking to this committee regarding the data, regarding the staleness of the information, and that the information that the committee had to use to develop that four-year plan was not accurate. What we know now from the work of the methodology committee is that our anecdotal information to this group was true, and that that information wasn't accurate and was in dire need of updating. I'm asking you to not continue to go forward with a plan based on inaccurate and faulty data. It's my opinion that to stubbornly hold on to this four-year plan in light and in face of the work group, the work group's information that you have before you today and that you'll hear in their presentation is dismissive of their work, but it's also destructive of our programs. last year I was here and I talked to you about the future and what it would mean to San Diego if this four-year plan continued to go forward for those 4 years. Today I'm here to talk to you about the very immediate consequences. It's not about the future for me anymore. If this committee continues to go forward with that four-year plan as it currently exists, my firm will close on August 31st of 2016. We cannot continue to do business at the amount allocated to us in San Diego at year two. I am not the only firm that's in this position. I'm the biggest right now. San Diego, I think, is the biggest county in this particular position, but there are people lined up behind me that will fall this year and next year.
You have 30 seconds.
It's a domino effect that's unnecessary, and so I'm asking you to reconsider the plan going forward with the information that you have today. Thank you.
Ms. Mays, thank you very much. And next, I believe, is Mr. Chan. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Roger Chan. I'm the Executive Director of East Bay Children's Law Offices in Alameda County. I also represent one of the 10 organizations serving 13 counties that submitted the joint written comment to you. First, I would also like to thank Judge Cope, Ms. Carter, and the other members of the subcommittee for the work that they did. And I want to say, first of all, that I urge this committee to adopt the recommended adjustments to the funding methodology, which are significant progress toward a more accurate workload model. But as the subcommittee noted, they did not have enough time to address all of the components of the workload model, and that work must continue, but with a timeline, because this is very much connected to our state budget advocacy. The advocates and the Judicial Council worked very closely to secure additional funding, full funding for Dependency Council from the state, which the Chief Justice spoke about on Tuesday, and she highlighted in her priorities for the budget. I would also like to join in Ms. May's request. When we were here last year, we did point out our very deep concerns that the current reallocation plan was based on outdated information. The subcommittee has now presented updated information, and that information must inform how the reallocation plan should continue. And one thing that we know for sure is that every county's dependency practice is underfunded in California. I agree with the goal of equity for children and parents in every county, but I'm not sure that equity for them is accomplished when we increase the caseloads of some to decrease the caseloads of other, while putting others of their lawyers out of business, as Ms. Mays indicated. And for my organization, with the upcoming reallocation cut, we are looking at a cut that will reduce two lawyers from my staff, which represents 20% of our children's attorneys. So I would also ask this committee to very carefully revisit and delay the reallocation plan, which is referenced in Recommendation 10. Thank you.
Mr. Chan, thank you very much. Next is, and I apologize, I'm just having a hard time reading the name. Is it Clencher Lloyd?
Close. Kelleher Cloyd.
That's what I get for trying.
That's okay. Kelleher Cloyd. I think it was my handwriting, actually, so my apologies, Judge.
Not a problem at all. You can get started. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Kelleher Cloyd. I'm the directing attorney of Legal Advocates for Children and Youth in Santa Clara County, and we represent all of the children in the foster care system there. Last year, my colleague David Myers said to this committee that all of the counties in California fall under three categories: underfunded, severely underfunded, and in crisis. And what you have before you today with the new methodology gives you the evidence that that statement was true. The report before you doesn't give you a new number to define what the actual need is, but it's obvious to any of us with basic math skills that the need is tens of millions more than the identified amount that we talked about in this meeting last year. And two nights ago, our Chief Justice highlighted that need as well to the legislature. My first request is that you do adopt the methodology that the committee worked so hard to develop in such a short period of time, despite the fact that there are a few things that all of us might like to improve. The methodology makes tremendous progress towards defining the appropriate need for all of our counties. But last year, you voted on a reallocation plan, but that entire plan was premised on a definition of need that is now completely debunked by this new methodology. To continue to blindly follow it, despite knowing its severe flaws, seems very limited. The landscape has frankly changed. The crisis counties received $11 million last year and all of the reallocation dollars.
This committee felt last year that it had no choice but to vote for the reallocation plan, or there might not be any new additional money from the governor and the legislature. We do not have confirmation that we are under that same directive this year. In Santa Clara County, this year's cut will result in a 25% attorney reduction for both kids and parents. What that means is that highly effective courts, like our drug treatment courts, will very likely not survive. And it drives us closer and closer to the brink of malpractice and incompetency. I urge you to consider freezing the reallocation, continue to give all new dollars allocated to those crisis counties, and ask our Judicial Council staff to calculate the true need with the new methodology so that we can all join together to advocate for those funds with the governor and the legislature. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Ms. Cruz.
Good morning. To the distinguished and honorable members of the Judicial Council, the Juvenile Dependency Attorneys representing parents and youth in Santa Cruz County, thank you for giving us this opportunity for public comment. We are a small county of three minors counsel and three parents attorneys. Yet prior to the mitigated reallocation implemented last year, we all had many years of experience in juvenile dependency. Minors counsel each have over 20 years, and parents' counsel ranged from 8 to 22 years. Last summer, unfortunately, one of our parents' counsel resigned due to the cut and promise of future cuts. The loss of one out of three attorneys for parents is obviously a devastating loss. Now, an inexperienced dependency attorney is representing parents who are facing the loss of their children. The two primary assistant county counsels who work in our courtroom have both been in their current positions for many years. For effective representation, parents and minors counsel must have comparable experience, and that will not happen unless the salaries are also comparable. We urge you to reject that portion of the Joint Subcommittee's recommendation number 10 that does not allow more time to consider the full spectrum of county council salaries. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. And finally, Ms. Goodman.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Andrea Goodman of San Francisco Council for Families and Children. I actually did not sign up for public comment, but I would like to direct your attention to the written public comment by the Bar Association of San Francisco. We join in those comments and join in the comments of all the prior speakers about the seriousness of the cuts. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you so much. All right. We provided opportunity for all those who have requested to present public speaking. They have done so. Also, as Ms. Goodman has acknowledged and joins in, there are written comments submitted to the committee. I assure all the public speakers that those timely received written comments, one even came in after the deadline, but I've allowed for that to be distributed as well, have been distributed to all of the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee members present today. With that being said, I'll turn now for the presentation on this issue, Judge Cope and Sherry Carter.
Thank you. I wanted to give just a brief introduction. There are 10 recommendations. Those recommendations, the rationale for each of those recommendations, the options considered are all contained in the report that has already been preliminarily presented to the Judicial Council, has been discussed with the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee, and is included in your materials. It's a pretty extensive report. And if it's okay with you, Judge Conklin, I'm not going to go through that.
So we're all the same sheet of music. Those are the recommendations, as I understand it, combined pages 42, 43, and 44.
That's right.
All right, so everybody has that. We're looking at the same thing. I'm sorry, Judge Cole, go ahead.
No, I appreciate that very much. But I did want to give a little bit of background. When the WAFM methodology was adopted by this committee and then adopted by the Judicial Council in 2013, April of 2013, this committee had a lot of extensive discussions late into the night at times about all there really is a countless number of issues that could have been involved, and a lot of those issues could have stopped the entire process. And so the committee had to, at some point, say, look, we're going to move forward and leave some issues for later resolution. And so they established a parking lot. It's a concept we're all familiar with. They established a parking lot with a number of issues that, the Budget Advisory Committee would have to come back to in the future. Lori Earle here was the chair of that committee, and she and Sherry Carter were so intimately involved in all this. They really, I was on the committee when it was adopted, but not for most of those conversations. Number three, item number three on the list of parking lot issues was what to do about the court-appointed dependency council. Court-appointed dependency council is a court responsibility. It has been since at least 1989. And it was, as trial court funding transitioned from the counties to the state, the funding allocation then ever since then has continued to be based on historical factors. So based on the level at which the court-appointed dependency council in one county was funded when it was a county obligation, that continued all through the years until recently. It was widely recognized that that created inequitable results. And as the report from Don Will, and I assume Audrey worked on that together, is that right? Okay, well, so he's not here, so she wants to throw him under the bus. But the report does a great job of pointing out the background that the legislature and the administration, the governor, were very concerned about the equities of continuing the historical distribution of funding here's the statement from, if I could read from Governor Brown's budget proposal for the 2015-16 fiscal year. He said, the current statewide average caseload is 248 cases per attorney. Many counties fall well within the standard, but others far exceed it. Judicial counsel allocations to courts are based on historical factors rather than on current caseloads. The administration will work with the judicial counsel to develop a caseload-based allocation methodology and explore ways to reduce the number of cases per attorney. So the imbalance and inequity led to a situation where dependency counsel in three counties were paid $1,500 per client. 20 counties, they paid the attorneys $500 per client. The caseloads varied widely, too. In addition, as has been discussed by the public speakers, this issue caught the attention of the legislature and the administration, and that led to this committee recommending last year in 2015, April of 2015, that the funding for court-appointed dependency counsel be based on workload, a caseload formula, rather than on historical funding. Judge Earle put together a committee that made that recommendation to this committee, and that recommendation went to the judicial counsel. There were a lot of public comments at that meeting. I wasn't there. Ms. Carter was there. There were a lot of public comments. There were a lot of judicial counsel comments. And as a result, they adopted that proposal, but they also directed further work to look at the formula that had been adopted by the council in 2007, right?
Yes.
Yeah, to look at that formula and then to see if any of it needs revision. And so a joint subcommittee of this committee, the Child Court Budget Advisory Committee, and the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee was put together. From the Budget Committee, it's myself, Ms. Carter, Mr. Yamasaki, and Judge Smith. And then there are six members from FamJuv on the committee as well. The last year has been spent working on that because we had a one-year deadline, and we report to the Judicial Council on April 15th or 16th?
14th or 15th, I believe, Thursday or Friday.
Okay, 14th or 15th with our recommendation. Our recommendation is included in the materials as we talked about. One of the things that we weren't asked to comment on was whether to continue the implementation over a period of 4 years. So that's why it's not in our report. I don't think I need to include any of the, well, I don't think I'd rather include any of the specifics from the recommendation. I think it's there. I do very much appreciate all the public comments that were made here and all the many, many public comments we've heard over the last year. The folks who are here today were also at many of our meetings, probably all of our meetings. There were also other folks there. We held meetings not only of the committee itself, subcommittee itself, but also we held public sessions, listening sessions in various locations around the state, all of them attended by staff, almost all of them attended by the judges as well. There were surveys conducted. There was a huge amount of outreach to make sure we had the input from all those involved. The bar and the bench for dependency cases is fairly small, very passionate, and very dedicated to their work, and we appreciate all of their comments. I don't think I could finish without saying the staff is fantastic, Stephen and Donville and Audrey here in the back. So, all right, that's what I would present. Is there anything else you want me to address or just open it up?
We can open it up. Unless, Sherry, do you have any comments?
Do you mind if I just add a couple of things?
Not at all.
Eloquent, okay. I just want to emphasize, Judge Cope had mentioned, that the reallocation was approved by the council. So if there's a question on whether or not the three remaining years are to proceed, that's already been decided by the council, and I think that's something that would need to be raised at their April meeting. That's not something that the working group was asked to look at. The working group had very finite things that they were assigned to look at, and the reason I know them almost by heart is because I helped put them together, because I chaired the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee that created the list, and along with Judge Earl, presented it to the council last April. I know that there's been feelings of that some of the numbers, I think I wrote down some of the words that were used, inaccurate, faulty. That's really not true. Those are just updates to a formula that's very, you know, that we do regularly with WAFM. They're related to benefits and salaries and things like that. That will make it a better formula. It doesn't mean they were faulty or inaccurate. It means that it was time for us to update a formula just like we do with WAFM. And you'll see the schedule on WAFM. We do it annually for certain categories and use averages, and those are things that we're trying to continue to do to improve an old formula. The numbers themselves that were from the child welfare, we're going to continue to use, but with a different model that we believe will have a little bit better accuracy on how it's applied to the formula. So, you know, there was a lot of work done by the joint working group. I think that it's resulted in a richer formula that will meet many of the needs that were raised at the council in April of last year in terms of addressing different cost of living in different areas of the state. So there are components in the new model that I believe address many of those areas. And I would, I believe that the letter outlines the excellent work that was done by this joint working group with the support of the Judicial Council, and would certainly support that we support it because the council has already seen it and it will be the foundation for the recommendations that come in April.
Judge, can I mention one other thing? I'm sorry, I forgot. Donwell couldn't be here. He's in Sacramento today advocating for more funding for this. But the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee, doing these joint subcommittees is a little awkward, but they have already met and considered this recommendation. They had asked that there be two minor modifications. One would be to clarify the process for small courts so as to request, to clarify that the process for small courts to request funding is in addition to the funding they'll receive through the methodology and the budget process itself. So it may supplement it, but it doesn't replace it. It's just meant to cover the fact that their spikes may be percentage-wise much larger than the spikes that would be felt in Los Angeles or even Riverside or others. The other point was modify the report to clarify that removing social worker full-time equivalents from the attorney caseload computation doesn't mean that social workers altogether are out of the methodology. all it does is put that over in the calculation for additional costs. It doesn't take them out. It just moves where they're calculated.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They're already included in that element of the formula.
So I needed to add that, and then.
So is that, are you making any changes to the subset of recommendations themselves?
No.
Okay,
no,
so they stand.
Just clarifying that in the report itself.
Understood. Thank you very much. Okay. Questions, comments?
I have a comment. I guess I'm really happy to hear the good work that the Joint Committee did on the methodology. But I do think that we should add something in the report or make some comment about the concerns that have been expressed. You know, my thought is that the plan is to build a bridge and start open the bridge next year or have it phased out. And when you get to the year two, it's what's supposed to be done or the effect of that is going to be so dramatic. I think we need to tell the Judicial Council that, the things that we heard. So if, in fact, the end result of going to year two plan is that law offices are going to close their door or that others are going to be underfunded, then I think that cautionary, that information should be conveyed to the council so that if it is their decision to make, that they know they need to address it when they're going into the plan. You know, everybody talks about how important council is in dependency proceedings, but what do we do when there isn't any more council? I mean, if the funding continues and doors close, then you can't just go out and get another group of them. There's training required. It's unfair to think that the reason why you're getting new counsel is because you can undercut them by dollar amounts to get them in the door. And so, you know, I think that while committees need to stay with what their tasks are, I think that if there is some consequence that we learn about in our process, that there should just be that additional caveat that we pass along, that this committee's not making a recommendation. You know, the Judicial Council voted to go to year two, but that there is some discussion that year two will have these devastating consequences. I don't think that they want to go ahead with something knowing that potentially San Diego doesn't have counsel anymore. So I think that when we hear those things at this level, while it doesn't change our task, which is what we've been doing so well, that we need to pass along that the council may want to address concerns directly, that we don't see it's our job as this advisory committee to talk to that, just like it's, I think it's decided before that it's not this advisory committee's task to maybe even recommend that dependency council isn't funded through the judicial branch, but has some other methodology. And especially when we know the chief talked about it in her 4 points in her State of the Judiciary comments and the importance of everything else. So if we know there's a time bomb or a potential time bomb and we don't highlight it for them, then if that comes to pass, they'll ask, what did the Child Court Budget Advisory Committee do? And I think that the recommendations are, in fact, what we should be presenting, and they worked really hard. But I think the fact that we learned information about it continuing to year two in the plan, especially if you talk about how it may not change the numbers so much that courts would say, you know, we can hold at the first year figures and do what we need to do, but moving forward may, because of the negative impacts, is not recommended by any of the courts. So I think that, I don't know how you add it in. I think that you support the recommendation because I think it's what we were tasked to do. But I think learning what we've heard today without passing that along, well, I think they'll wonder, you know, what, if, because I can imagine that these comments are going to be made to the Judicial Council. And I think they'll ask, well, if the committee heard about it, why wasn't that passed along in some way to us? And that we're not making a recommendation to hold because they didn't look into it.
So can I just say that in every single meeting that we had of the joint working group, there were public comments made, and these were very similar comments at every single one of those meetings. So the joint working group heard these meetings or heard these comments and continued to write the report, because on the flip side of what we heard are the counties that are currently so significantly below the workload or above the workload standard with their attorney caseload, they're not being represented here. And so there is a much broader picture than what we're hearing today. And in every one of those meetings, and Judge Cope, correct me if I'm wrong, there was always a public comment period. They were very open And so these were not new comments, and they were heard, and this was still the resulting document.
And the only, I'll just say one more thing. So the only point I have is that really the point is that it's so, the Dependency Council is so severely underfunded that it isn't that some are getting, you know, living in the life of lavish and others aren't. It's a equaling that I just think that going to your, if going to year two means that courts, that council is not going to exist anymore, then I think that's the unintended consequence. I mean, if it's really not going to happen, if that was investigated and they don't think it's going to happen, but if that is the unintended consequence of what goes on, then the Dependency Council will be in a much bigger mess than they are right now.
All right, Judge Coughlin and Chris Mulpers.
This is another example where the legislation to govern gives us X amount of dollars, and it's short what we really need. So based on the amount of money we have to settle. We have to dispense this money in an equitable manner. On the other hand, is that the Chief Justice on Tuesday says we need more money. I think we all agree we need more money, and I think we all should be working together to get that money. And then if we have more money, then we can dispense it appropriately. But in the meantime, we have this amount of money, and we have to come up with a way to solve it. And so I think the message that has to be delivered is that, yes, we're going to dispense with it equitably, but on the other hand, we are pushing, charging full steam ahead to get as much money as we can, because this is a very important topic. This is kids. This is children. And we have to protect them and render justice in a fair and equitable manner.
Right. I think that's an excellent point. I don't want to speak too broadly, but I don't think there can be a criticism that this committee has not been more than aggressive in making known to the council and to the governor and the legislature the need for additional funding. Our task is to work within that funding that was provided and to decide with distributing the pain as best we can, recognizing that all we're doing is distributing pain by these cuts. But Chris Volkers, and then I believe David Yamasaki, Judge Herman, and then Judge Smith, and then I think we're on schedule. Chris?
So I couldn't agree more with Judge Kaufman that this is about children, and they're, I don't think anybody in this room would dispute the critical need that this funding shows. In addition, I would say, though, that the other side, as Cherry mentioned, is that the unintended consequences are truly the unintended consequences, but you only have a certain pot of money, and all those courts like San Bernardino, Riverside, etc., who simply don't have the council now. So there is that side. It's not that, oh, all of us will agree that if we do this second year that some counties won't have the council. The reality is right now that is happening in other courts. So there is truly two sides to this discussion and argument, and today you did not hear from that other side. We did last year. We heard from all the sides. We had comments from every side last year, but today we didn't hear from the other side of that for consideration. So, thank you,
David Yamasaki.
Thank you, Judge. So, full disclosure: I was a member, as Judge Cope had indicated, on this joint subcommittee, and I will tell you that this was extremely difficult for us to try to feed more mouths, perhaps, than we possibly could. But the notion and the way that we came up with the methodology was to bring up the courts that had workloads that were growing, perhaps, but and well above the formula. But the notion of having to build programs by dismantling others or severely, reducing them in their fragile state troubles me because the underlying remedy for this is to actually get more funding for this program. And we know, just from the information that we had discussed last year, that we needed 30-some-odd million, and this year there wasn't anything in the governor's proposed budget to supplement the 11. Not included in the information was the action that was taken up for this budget year, that any new money that was infused in this program would be going to those courts that fell short of that formula. And that obviously is something that is really important. It demonstrates a commitment that we have to bring up those other programs. But
the notion that, you know, we have offices like in San Diego that they're actually going to be shutting down, that's not something that I feel comfortable doing. And I think we have to be very careful of recognizing the realities, the law of unemployment. Those are realities that we're going to have. And perhaps, you know, it's one of the suggestions that was raised was perhaps freeze the distribution formula going forward, which again is different from what I was recommending going forward. But never did we realize that these cuts would demonstrate severe dismantling that's going on to an already fragile program. So I hope that this is something that, and it relates to recommendation number 10, that is something that we can, you know, reevaluate today, whether we should go forward with that.
Very good. Thank you. Judge Herman?
Well, I'm new to the committee, obviously, but, you know, I share Saki's view. You know, I'm from a court where this will have an impact, so I want to disclose that. You know, we really are robbing Peter to pay Paul in this particular situation. At the very least, it seems to me, since this is a council directive, that that the council has suggested earlier, should be made aware of this issue specifically in terms of our report and recommendation to the council. You know, the chief has made this a priority. The chief needs the ammunition that she needs in order to work with the governor as well as the legislature, and I think bringing squarely to the attention of those bodies by way of the council is important in terms of getting additional funding. So I don't see any downside in terms of if the recommendation passes and if we don't go to into a freeze mode of including in our report and recommendation to the council the impact that this is going to have. It's going to have impact on in my county in terms of dependency council, and we've got our dependency teams in north and south is, you know, in the 20-year experience range, and I know it's affecting San Diego and Santa Clara and other counties. So I think that message needs to get out there.
All right, I'm going to let Judge Cope comment on that briefly, and then it's Judge Smith who's next up. But no, Mark, did you want to respond to Judge Herman?
I think Laura Earle after her.
Right, I've got Judge Smith, Judge Saunders, and Judge Earle.
You know, if I could just, I want to make sure it's understood that when we started this process out of the 58 courts, there were, the courts receive on average 74% of the identified need for this program for court appointed dependency counsel. It was about 75.7%. Stephen, if I say any numbers wrong, you'll correct me.
Statewide,
exactly. Statewide. All 58. Out of the 58 courts, 26 of those courts receive funding in excess of that 75.7%. So they could be funded at 85% of their need, but still be above average. 32 courts received below the average number of 75.7%. Those courts have not been here for public comments. I don't know why, but they're not. They have a voice just as much as those who have been able to be here. And the problem with including anything in the report is that's much more of a process to find that input than just hearing public comments. That means actually going out to those folks and finding out what they think about this whole process. Should we stop where we're going to fund, you know, let's choose San Mateo County that got 30.7% of their identified need. Should we stop trying to bring them up to the average? It's not as simple and as straightforward as saying, let's just hold off until some unidentified point in the future. So I would be opposed to including anything like that in the report.
All right, very good. Judge Smith?
Well, I think rather than talking about resolving it now and saying that we should stop or not stop, I think the issue is really advising the council that this is an issue that needs to be examined. So they may, A, decide not to do it. They may decide that it needs to be examined, and after examining it, however that happens, that they don't want to change it. But I don't think there's a problem with simply saying, this has come up, as an issue, and maybe as an advisory comment that they may want to consider looking at this issue again, including the voices of all of the affected counties. And so they would solicit opinions from those under counties that are considered severely underfunded, and as well as listening to the voices. And I would say, too, just, and I'm on this subcommittee, that there really has been a terrific collaboration, I think, with all the advocates. And I know I have very much appreciated their input. And excuse me, guided us in a way that has helped us be much more productive. So I think when we hear this, it's not just words, rhetoric. It is really a red flag saying we need to be heard on this, and can you just bring it up? So I'm just simply saying bring it up, an advisory comment saying that it needs to be bring. Even if we say to the council, however you want to address it, give us some direction, not necessarily making a recommendation, but I think it does need to be brought up to the council. I think it needs to be addressed by the council, or at least brought up so that they can decide if they want to address it and how serious an issue they think it is. But I think to simply not to say it's not within, you know, our charge and to not say anything about it, I think we're doing a disservice to all the work we've done. So that's my only comment.
All right, next, Judge Saunders.
Yes, I'm deeply concerned by the fact that continuing with the three-year phase-in allocation is going to quite literally destroy firms that have been in existence for more than 21, 25 years that may not again be resuscitated if and when we ever get full funding for court-appointed counsel. It seems to me that Recommendation 10 does contemplate the notion of a possible freeze of the implementation process. That's exactly what the recommendation discusses. And I think instead of simply advising the council that this is an issue, which we know Judge Borak has already done at the last meeting, I would make a motion that we suspend the remaining three-year phase-in reallocation plan but allocate any new funds to the severely underfunded counties.
All right. Thank you, Judge Saunders. Judge Earl. So I
just want to remind everyone that we had these exact same discussions when we were trying to come up with a new funding methodology for the branch overall. We're all underfunded. There's no winners and losers here. And what we are doing is we're trying to take the money we do get and make it distributed at least more equitably. And we can't do that the way we've been doing it in the past. You have what they've drawn a line is what the statewide funding average is, and there are some that are above it and some are below it. And the only way to reach parity is that the ones above it have to come down a little bit so that the ones below it can come up. And that's, is that right? No, because we need more money. We're all underfunded. But there isn't really another way to do that and make it change. And I support the recommendation. I specifically oppose Judge Sanders' recommendation to suspend this without looking at this further, because I really believe if we don't move forward with this, we will not see any restoration of funding from the governor in this area. If we sit back and say, we're going to wait for you to give us more money, when we know from what he put in his budget last year is that once you change it, I'll give you more money. I think we're doing ourselves a disservice. To Judge Henrich's point, though, I think it is our responsibility to advise the council that there are concerns about what it looks like next year. And there's different ways to do that. One way to do that would be for this group to address it. The other way to do it would be during the presentation to the council on this issue is to give them an update on what has happened since they first adopted the recommendation in 2015. What happened in year one, which we're in now? What does year two look like? So that they can see what is the impact of next year going to be on these courts, and is it worth taking a look at and refining that?
So your suggestion, not to put words in your mouth because you do that so well, but your suggestion would be the recommendations be adopted, but we advise the council of the impact of the recommendations. And if the council wants to take action and the council wants to turn back and say, adjust this, they can do that. But the recommendations as we have, and the reason I'm emphasizing that is I think the voice of somebody who worked on WAFM and the struggles and went through WAFM is very important to consider.
So I guess I would then And I don't know.
Yeah, there's no motion yet. So yes, yeah.
There is a motion pending.
Okay, so Judge, then let me clarify. Judge Saunders' motion is to adopt.
To suspend the remaining 3-year phase-in reallocation plan, but allocate any new funds to the severely underfunded counties, and to adopt the recommendation to continue developing the attorney workload model.
Okay, so there's a motion. That's Judge Saunders' motion.
Judge, I would like to second that motion. Okay.
Mr. Yamasaki has seconded. So that motion is pending.
I have a question. Is Judge Saunders moving all of the other recommendations? You're just looking at recommendation number 10?
That's correct.
Just 10?
Yes.
Okay, so all other so Judge Saunders' motion is to adopt all recommendations 1 through 9 as set forth, and then 10 to modify, stating, and I'll ask you to read.
No, that's not correct. The recommendation is to suspend the remaining 3-year phase-in, and at the same time to continue to work on the model, because the preceding 9 assume that we don't need any further work. So my motion is as it reads.
I need some clarification.
I'm a little confused on that one. So we have a motion on the floor, and I'm not necessarily quite astute on the Robert's rules, whether
there's
we can take those.
You have now seconded, and
right.
I asked Judge Saunders to clarify her motion, because now we have to vote on that motion. It's been seconded.
Right, okay.
I think her motion is only as to recommendation number 10. Right.
And Judge Saunders appears to disagree with that.
Well, the problem with saying it doesn't affect any of the other recommendations is that some of the other recommendations don't take into account the moving target with regard to the numbers.
Can I ask what you see as a moving target there?
I think to clarify it, perhaps it is probably makes more sense logically to say that, in fact, it's recommendation 10 that I take issue with. It is recommendation 10.
And my second is related to specifically just item number 10.
It is item number 10.
So is your,
yes.
And I'm just trying to be as careful as I can, is your motion to approve all with recommendation number 10 as modified, or is your motion only on number 10?
Yes, that's correct.
Only on number 10?
Yes, that is correct.
So we have a motion now concerning item 10 only, seconded by Mr. Yamasaki.
Yes.
Now, comments on that. I believe we still had asking to be heard, Judge Herman. Or did you want to?
Yeah, I just say that I was on the council when we approved the good work that was done relative to WAFM, and Judge Walsh was the chair of PJ Advisory at that time, and his comment has always struck me, because when he presented on WAFM, his statement was, he's my little brother, he's not that heavy. And I think all of us that are in the kind of donor category on WAFM in various phases are very much committed to that we should level the playing field. By the same token, this is going to have significant negative impacts, and it seems to me in terms of future funding streams and also in terms of helping the chief go forward with her agenda on this, that it's important to keep focused that there are negative impacts on courts that may disassemble various law firms. So.
All right. Mike Roddy?
I oppose the original recommendation to the council to implement the 4-year plan, because at that point we all knew that this was a moving target. To me, these recommendations validate that. And in fact, I think the recommendations will result in an even greater ask than the $22 million that's remaining. I appreciate that the governor has indicated if we make these adjustments that he'll step up to the plate, but he didn't this year. And so now we're going to have to work through the legislative process to try to make that happen. I would have been more impressed with the governor's support for this prior recommendation that went to the council if he had, in fact, added another $11 million in some fashion to keep that progress going. I think it's more difficult in this particular area that as we look to achieve what I would call the arithmetic equality of WAFM, that we're going to tear apart programs that affect children and families. Yes, we have significant deficits in a number of the counties. Those deficits have existed long before state funding. Because if you go back to the original basis for which we our dependency budgets were set, it was based on what we had at the local level. Clearly, there were different priorities in place depending on the county you were in. Now, as we move to a workload-based model, and I think that's the appropriate way to go, the question is, what damage do we do in that process? And I think it's wholly appropriate to say we're going to hold the line, and those programs that are providing a decent level of service, and I won't even say that it's great, but a decent level of service can continue to operate so that we can raise the rest of these programs to that same level. But to harm those children and families, to me, differentiates from the idea that, you know, on the operations side of the WAFM budget, I may have to have somebody drive 35 miles to file their small claims matter. This is in the courtroom. It puts judges in untenable positions who have to make individual specific decisions on a case-by-case basis. And I think for me, the difference is this is where we need to hold the line, and we need to strongly advocate, and we need to get the administration to back this up by showing them capably administered programs instead of tearing us all down to an inadequate average. And so I think the confusion in the motion, to maybe finish what I'm going to say, is that the recommendations don't specifically address this freezing aspect of holding it at the, and it seems to be kind of outside the purview of this report, and that may choose to be an independent recommendation we may make to the council, but I think these 10 recommendations in and of themselves need to stand because they do, I think, articulate the degree to which the program is so significantly underfunded.
All right. I'm going to come back to Judge Smith, and then Rebecca Fleming, and then Sherry Carter, and then Judge Earl, I think. Okay, and then, so let's do our... I'm wanting everybody a chance to be heard. We got plenty of time built into the schedule this afternoon, so we're going to go a little bit long now. We may condense the lunch hour, but I think it's more important, obviously, that these comments be heard than we have a long lunch hour. So that being said, Judge Smith.
Yeah, I do actually support the motion, and I think that what maybe we may accomplish...
No, I'm sorry, just for clarification, which motion?
Judge Saunders' motion.
Okay.
I think what we would accomplish is to put it front and center to the council, even if we accomplish them looking at the issue right now. Because one thing that I think is important to remember is that, we're, first of all, the recommendation might be to not only suspend it, but to allocate all the new money to the severely underfunded courts. And also the recommendation for the reallocation was sort of made in a vacuum. It was before the new information or the revised or refreshed information was clear to the committee. So I think with all that additional information, this might be a way of getting it before the council and to look at it and to look at it equitably. So I don't think the issue would be to simply say, well, we're going to freeze it, but to look at it and say, well, okay, well, the recommendation is to freeze, but before we make a decision to adopt that, maybe we will either look at it carefully as to what the effect of freezing it with the new information that we have on effective funding, the effects on counties that may be really severely affected in ways we're not anticipated, and that if they may want to shift around in a different way altogether. But I think if it puts it in front of the council, that's a good thing.
So I want to make sure now that the recommendation 10, Judge Saunders' language is on recommendation 10 is to suspend.
To freeze. No, and I'm saying I think it's a good idea because if we recommend to freeze, then it may just bring the issue up for further analysis by the council because they don't have to adopt the recommendation even if we make it, but I think it will put it front and center in front of the council for review and consideration.
All right.
Whatever they decide to do with it.
Rebecca Fleming.
So, full disclosure, Mr. Myers actually provides services in Stanislaus, and they do a fantastic job. And as all of you know, Stanislaus is at the bottom of the funding model in WAFM, but we're not with the Dependency Council. We are actually above the 74%. But I think this proposal is progress, and I think that it would be inconsistent for us to do anything other than to support an equity model for the branch. And it would be a mixed message, I think, for everybody outside the branch. I think that the voices on all sides are important. And one of the things I take exception with is our reference to how important the children are, because the children in Stanislaus who are being serviced at 100% are just as important as the children in San Bernardino or in those courts that are not. And I think it's important that we
do everything we can to support each other and reach out to encourage each other. And my question, you know, would be, I don't think the priority of children is a question in this room. I would say, why is it not a priority at the governor's office? And that we put more pressure in that regard, because we didn't see anything. I mean, everybody's voices have been 100% behind this program, and I don't see us tearing down something. I see us trying to stabilize each other. And so I would not support the motion respectfully, but I would say that it is important to make sure these voices are still at the Judicial Council level, because I think we are moving in a consistent direction. And I actually applaud the committee. I think a tremendous amount of effort has been done, and I think that they have looked at a number of sides, and this is a tremendous amount of progress, I think.
Very good. Thank you, Rebecca. Next, Sherry Carter.
I want to remind those of you who were on the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee last year, and I think many of you are new. I did the presentation to the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee before it went to the council last year. And it was a very heated debate, very much like today. We had very similar comments, very much like today. And the vote was split primarily with those courts that were above the 75% and those below the 75%, but it did pass and went to the council as a recommendation. The governor did not include any money in his budget, and there was a lot of skepticism that by having an equitable formula, we would be rewarded. In fact, those comments were expressed in the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee that there is no reason to believe that if we do this, that we'll get new money. The governor gave us $11 million. He told us last year he will not put money into a broken system. When we approved this methodology and when we approved the first year of reallocation, the governor gave us $11 million. I would propose to you that he may be doing the same thing this year. He may be waiting to see how this is all going to come down and may include it in the end, because that's what he did last year. I think we are hurting the branch when we take a position that we do not believe in equity for all of our trial courts. I think Mike is absolutely right. The inequity started when we were part of the counties. That was 16 years ago. We're a state court now. We need to start looking at our funding methodologies in a process that is more equitable. And I think that we need to recognize, as Rebecca said, we're being very inconsistent by not taking that position. And I think it hurts the branch, and I think it will hurt us if we don't support these recommendations, because I think they were well-founded, they were well thought through, and it was not part of the charge to look at whether or not to freeze them or not. That is something the council should do. Now, if we need to make, as Mike suggested, make a separate statement or a separate comment that they need to consider that. I love Judge Earl's comments about including a document that will reflect what it will do, because maybe it is too severe for next year, and let the council reevaluate its position. But I think that we are going to hurt the branch by such a motion. I know we would have hurt the branch last year if that would not have passed, because he rewarded us with $11 million after we approved this formula. So I am not in support of the motion as well.
Okay, so we've got Judge Earl, David Yamasaki, and then back to Judge Saunders, and then I think we're just about, Judge Lee as well. So we'll go to Judge Lee after Judge Saunders. Judge Earl.
Thank you. I wanted to reiterate, and Sherry took the words from me, and I wanted to correct the record a little bit, because when this was first approved by the council in April of 2015, the governor then gave us $11 million for an increase of $11
million. Right.
And so there was some suggestion that he didn't, and he did. And I do believe he's waiting to see the rest of the work before we get more funding. I also don't believe that the focus should be on what's in the best interest, you know, that we're here, it's all about the children. I sit in a dependency department. I know very well what my charge is, and I think this entire committee knows as well. And I don't think that we should be making a decision to free something without having the numbers that show us what's the impact. What's the impact at 40%? Should it be 30%? Should it be 20%? But to just say we're not going to do this because it's hard, I think is wrong.
All right, very good. Thank you, Judge. David Yamasaki.
Thank you, Judge. So I'm obviously very
moved by all of the discussion that is taking place today. But, you know, when we developed WAFM, one of the things, as Judge Cope indicated, that we wanted to reserve were things in the parking lot. And those parking lot items would grow from year to year, perhaps. And, you know, just to make sure that we are on the right path and some of the decisions that we have made. And I see this as something that is relatively the same. This is a parking lot item. And we contemplated a way to remedy the disparity in funding with the different courts by agreeing that any new funding would go to those courts that fell below that number. And that is something that continues to move forward. But as we have heard last year, and we now know this year, that courts or programs are going to completely cease to operate, that is something that we have to listen to. I mean, those are real situations. And, you know, we came up with a funding floor for those courts that didn't really fall within the WAFM methodology as a remedy to keep them afloat. And this is the same approach. And that's the reason why I am, I've seconded the motion. We didn't do a perfect job the first time out. And so we have to continue to support opportunities to generate funding. On Tuesday, I was in Sacramento all day advocating for more funding in this program, among other things, realizing that not one dime would be going to many of the courts, including mine. So the advocacy will continue. I will tell you there was a lot of support from the folks that I spoke with on Tuesday. And, you know, just going back to that that issue, I think rebuilding or building should not be the product of dismantling. And I think that's what we've heard today from a lot of the programs up and down the state that would be their reality if the escalating formula were to move forward. Agree. We need to do something for those courts that fall below the line, but we have to be very careful about the unintended consequence of services that will just stop.
Thank you. Judge Saunders, back to you. Did you have another comment?
I think Judge Lee was ahead of me.
Okay, Judge Lee.
I don't know if I do, but I appreciate Judge Saunders.
I cede the floor.
Thank you, Judge Saunders. You know, I come from San Francisco. We're a donor court. We've already been hit umpteen and a million times. But I think one of the things that we are, as a court, committed to is parity and equality and access to justice for all courts, even if we're being hit time and time again. You know, I read through the letter from our local bar association, and I've had many conversations with Ms. Tron and Mr. Chan about the issues. You know, and it's troubling because of the fact that I disagree somewhat with my colleague, Judge Earle, in terms of children and the priorities, because they are a vulnerable population, and to not have a lawyer for the child, to not have a lawyer for the parent, in some instances may make a sham of the whole proceedings, and it's not right. On the other hand, we have other imperatives that we have to look to. Last year, we made cuts. The governor did come up with some money. The message is clear, again, as Sherry noted. If we don't make some changes, if we don't make some cuts, he's not going to give us more money. That may not be right, but that's the way it is. And I think it's a tough choice that we have to make in terms of the motion that's on the floor. I think I'm more interested in getting this information to the council and saying, you know, we did not have the perfect information last year. We had the warnings from the advocates as to how this was going to play out. Maybe there was some skepticism in the room about it, you know, because there were many different groups that presented to the different committees about what would happen with slashes and cuts. I also am on the subcommittee for revenues and expenditures, and I have to tell you, I doubt that I would ever do it again because we made some very painful cuts and slashes in programs all over the place last year because we had an $11 million deficit. I mean, we cut education programs, we cut things left and right that we never would have thought that were sacred cows. Perhaps not at the same level or with the same importance as children, but we made the cuts because we need to do business differently. What this leads me to, I think, conclude is that with regard to Judge Saunders' motion, I support it, but I'm not going to vote for it. And the reason for that is because I am committed, as I think we all are, to effecting change in the branch for the better for the future. Yes, it's a gamble. If we don't vote to kind of roll back this particular phase in as to whether the governor is going to give us the money. But I think we should be bringing it to the attention of the council and to say this was, although maybe a foreseeable effect in some respects, it's played out in a disastrous way. And make it a point to the council. I don't know whether we want to do it by way of a recommendation or an advisory request for them to reconsider the original plan or whether to roll it back in part so that these programs, such as the one in San Diego, can survive. Because it is really a crime for children and parents not to have counsel.
I'm going to go to Judge Saunders. I would just briefly comment that last week I appeared before the council on the AB 1058 issue, and when the report went to the council from this committee, it included language from this committee about the discussion. So I think there is a way to formulate a report to the council to summarize the concerns of this committee and state them as such. Now, I don't know what the vote's going to be. The vote also can be detailed, but the council can clearly be told there was significant discussion and the concern was X, Y, and Z. That being said, Judge Saunders?
Yes, I want to make it very clear that I also completely support the need for collaboration amongst all the counties. And as you know, my predecessor was very involved in the Waffen formula and working with Judge Earl and others, making some painful decisions. And Orange County has sustained cuts as a result of some of those decisions. And I completely supported that, and I continue to support that. I think the difference here is that we are quite literally destroying, eliminating, dismantling law firms with attorneys that have a deep, broad specialization in dependency and juvenile law. And I don't know that we can reconstitute those firms again. So before we take an action that has such dire consequences, perhaps irreversible consequences, it seems to me we need more thought before we continue to implement the three-year phase-in. I think we are nevertheless showing the governor that we have worked towards changing the system because of the other recommendations that are being made by the subcommittee, which I understand how much thought and effort went into it. I think it's not as if we're going forward with recommendations to the Judicial Council without any progress. A great deal of progress has been made. The mere freezing or suspending for a one-year period so that we can further examine the disastrous consequences, which may be irreversible, does not, I think, impede the prospects of more money. And I think it's dangerous to be perhaps tilting at windmills, speculating about what is going on in the mind of the governor concerning whether or not he will give us money. I think I've said my piece.
Great, thank you. And finally, Mike Planet.
So I just want to say a couple words as one of the underfunded courts. Ventura is at the bottom, close to the bottom, if not the bottom of the list in terms of the funding. This past year has been a huge benefit for us. As a 14th largest court, with this, we've been able to grow our combined attorney work population, if you will, from 4 to 7 to handle this caseload. And we're still doesn't put us anywhere close to the 74% or whatever that number is. So I appreciate all the problems and the concerns. I do not support the motion. I think it would be best for us to stay the course. I support the 10 recommendations. But I also do support raising this issue to the council so they're aware of it as well.
Last year when we voted in the trial court budget advisory committee, it was actually a compromised because the original proposal was to reduce by 20%. We went down to 10, and that was a very tight vote. 15 to 13 was the final vote. You know, I share the concerns that have been raised by Judge Saunders and also the points that have been raised by Sherry. I know that this issue is very much in the forefront of the legislature, and I have, for example, told our dependency council in our county, you need to go to the chair of the Judiciary Committee, who happens to be our own assemblyman, Mark Stone, because he's very, very important with respect to the funding on this. I'm not sure that we can change the council's view on what it is they decided last year or have them freeze it. But the idea that council, who have been doing this kind of work for decades, will now be unable to handle these and is something that is of very, very great concern to me because of the ramifications to the families and to the entire justice system. I would hope that if we don't have the vote, if it isn't the same way, that we can send the strongest message possible to the council that this issue really needs to take some time before going forward. All right? I believe, okay, I'm sorry.
I just have one more thing, and that is I'm not sure where I stand on Judge Saunders' motion because I agree with Judge Earl, who agreed with me sort of initially, but I do think that what we don't get at this level that the Joint Committee may have had more was hearing from everybody. You get a summary and then you hear from some and you don't get the full perspective. I mean, I think almost it's worth asking or recommending that the answer comes in of all 58 counties. It may be that what others are going to gain in the second year is not worth what is lost in the second year. But I don't feel like we have the information to know that. But I think the Judicial Council needs to be aware that it's a huge issue and that either they advise this committee to do more or some other committee to do more, and then they make that decision and that it gets get alerted to them. And obviously the motion that's made sort of forces their hand in that regard, and I'm not sure that that's our role is to force their hand. I think our role is to make those recommendations that have come through a process, which in this case was a Joint Committee process, and then to be able to say that this is a problem that really the final decision makers of our branch need to make, and to make that as clear as we can to them, so that then everybody that states their position, those that are still underfunded, and those that, I mean, they're all underfunded because we're only getting to 74%, but those that are severely underfunded and those aren't, and that then discuss or outline what some of the suggestions are that get to be made. Because I do think that having legal offices completely close is something that they need to be aware of when they're balancing what could be gained by staying the course. And so, anyway, that's...
Point of order. So we're going
to
go
I'm going to try to clarify that right now. So a couple things. I'm going to do that. I'm going to speak first as the chair, and then I don't think as the chair it's appropriate for me to first as the chair, what I want to make clear is I think the comments of, and I've kept track, and I think almost every member of this committee has spoken to it, exemplify the passion and the dedication that this committee has for this issue. And whatever the outcome, any perception that this committee did not consider what Judge Saunders described as disastrous consequences is unfair. Because this committee has considered that. And whatever the vote is, I want it to be clear that this discussion has gone on much longer than the agenda item allowed for because it's appropriate. And it shows how important this decision is and the work that's gone into it. So I believe right now what's pending is a single motion from Judge Saunders, seconded by David Yamasaki. And I believe if we look at recommendation number 10, I believe, and Judge Saunders, correct me if I'm wrong, but what your motion is, if we look down to line 5, that your motion is that it now reads, this pending work should freeze the phase-in period previously approved by the Judicial Council for implementing all new dependency council funding methodology. Is that correct? It's a long recommendation, and that's why I'm trying to be as clear as I can. Judge Koh?
I have my words clearly. I have my words in front of me, but you have to give me your insertion again.
Well, all I'm trying to do is if you want to use your words, but you said freeze. So if we look at...
I actually used the word suspend. We've been casually saying freeze, but this is my motion. To suspend the remaining three-year phase-in reallocation plan, but allocate any new funds to the severely underfunded counties and adopt the recommendation to continue developing the attorney workload model.
Can I seek a clarification? I'm sorry. So, Judge Saunders, there already is an approved methodology for new money that allocates. When we say severely underfunded, it's a vague term. There's actually an allocation process that's been approved by the council that it goes to those that are a certain percentage under the average. And so, yes. I would
continue with that.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm just not sure how this works, because I said the joint subcommittee process is an awkward one. This isn't a recommendation from the trial court budget advisory committee. All we can do is recommend back to the joint subcommittee that they change their recommendation. Unless you tell me otherwise, because I'm not sure how to approach this.
Right, that's recommendation number 10. We dealt somewhat analogous. This was the 1058 issue last week. It was a joint subcommittee. But I remind you all that we, in a somewhat similar passionate discussion, came to a vote to actually recommend different than the Joint Subcommittee to recommend. I went before the council last week and I said, here's what the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee's recommendation is in relation to the recommendation of the Joint Subcommittee, and action was taken on that. But Judge Cope is correct. Item 10 is a recommendation concerning the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee.
So if you're, maybe what you're proposing would be the recommendation from the Joint Subcommittee would be its recommendation, but there would be an additional recommendation from this committee.
Judge Saunders, is that what you're saying?
Yes, it has to be that. I can't supplant the recommendation. I think you were trying to put my recommendation, my motion into the recommendation of the subcommittee. I obviously can't do that.
Okay, so it would be the same thing. It would be your motion now is that the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee make a separate...
That's correct.
Okay, and that's been seconded by David Yamasaki. Any further discussion? So I'm going to do a roll call on this and ask Stephen concerning roll call, just as he goes around, either yes or no. Yeah, let's just call individually. So this is on the item 10, recommendation 10 only.
I'll start with the judges again. Judge Barton.
I'm sorry.
Oh. What do you mean?
What do you mean?
Yeah, recommendation.
I'm sorry, not recommendation. Is this Judge Sanders' recommendation? I'm sorry. This is Judge Sanders' motion, seconded by David Yamasaki.
Can you just rephrase the motion for me?
Or restate it?
Restate the motion.
Should I read it again?
Yes.
No. In terms of, are we voting on recommendation number 10, or it's a separate recommendation?
It's a separate recommendation.
It's not a recommendation. It's my motion.
Okay.
And it's separate from number 10 completely. To suspend the remaining three-year phase-in reallocation plan, but allocate any new funds to the severely underfunded counties and adopt the recommendation to continue developing the attorney workload model.
All right, and seconded by David Yamasaki.
All right, we're going to proceed with the vote. Judge Barton? Judge Barton? Judge Cope?
No.
Judge Earl?
No.
Judge Good?
No.
Judge Herman?
No.
Judge Heinrichs?
No.
Judge Holland? Judge Holland? Judge Kaufman?
No.
Judge Kuhl?
No, I have a proxy.
Judge Lee?
No.
Judge Mirakonda?
Yes.
Judge McKay? Judge McKay? Judge Saunders?
Yes.
Judge Smith?
Yes.
Sherry Carter?
No.
Rick Feldstein. Rebecca Fleming.
No.
Tammy Grimm.
No.
Jose Guillen. Samuel Hemrick.
No.
Kevin Harrigan.
No.
Jeffrey Lewis.
No.
Michael Planet.
No.
Mike Roddy.
Yes.
Brian Taylor.
No.
Linda Romero-Solez.
No.
Tanya Ugrin Capo Bianco.
No.
Christina Volkers.
No.
David Yamasaki.
Yes.
And Judge Conklin?
No.
So
the motion has failed. So now...
I'd like to make a motion.
Okay, so now Sherry Carter has a motion.
Okay, I would like to move that we support and approve the memo that has been prepared by the Joint Working Group, but I would also recommend that we provide to the council a... materials prepared by Judicial Council staff that would show the 40-60 split so they clearly can see the impact. Plus, if there are any other, the 40-60 split so they will have the information and they can see the impact of what that would, what it would look like.
So is your motion to approve 1 through 10?
Yes.
This is Tammy Grimm on the phone, and I would second Sherry's motion.
So Sherry's motion has been seconded. I have to keep everything clear. Seconded by Rebecca Fleming at the same time, Tammy Grimm. Judge Kaufman?
I think Judge Earl would have a friendly amendment to that.
I do have a friendly amendment, and that is, Sherry, could you, you consider that the Judicial Council staff also prepare a spreadsheet as to the impact of before we started and what happened this year in 15-16 and what happens next year.
I think that's a great addition so they have the whole picture.
Thank you. All right, friendly amendment, and Sherry's accepted that as seconded. All right, so that's the motion pending. Any further discussion on that motion by any members? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, so now all the 10 recommendations have been adopted and accepted with the friendly amendment and the report to be prepared candidly, whether I appear before the Judicial Council or whatever way it is done, is the disastrous consequences concept will be presented to the Council. But thank you again very much, everybody, for your comments, and most importantly to the subcommittee for a very difficult and ongoing chore. Now, we're at 1:40. We're going to now break for lunch. It was originally slotted for 45 minutes. Candidly, as you can see, my habit is to build into the last half of the agenda sort of soft time. We're going to be out of here by 2 o'clock at the latest. I know weather's coming in. So perhaps if we could keep lunch to half an hour to 1:15, and then how do you want to work this? So what I would ask, too, is that 1 o'clock? All right. And if we can meet... Everybody, please, in a non-public session, to take nothing to do with anything other than personnel business in a good sense, please meet in the anteroom at 1 o'clock for a minor acknowledgement of service. Thank you. And I'm going to do my best to making sure everybody has a chance to be heard, get us out of here as soon as we can. So that gets us next to item 6 on the agenda. Are we back on? Are we back on, Stephen? Yeah. Okay, I believe we are back in open meeting and on. So that gets us to item 6, court request for a children's waiting room distribution. Chris Volkers.
Thank you, Judge. As you can see, the application we are making is to open for the first time in San Bernardino children's waiting rooms in two of our locations. The San Bernardino, or the Justice Center, the new Justice Center, was built with the waiting, with the children's waiting room, with the restrooms in the waiting room and a thing that you put a bracelet on the child, and it tracks their coming and goings, et cetera. So we've got the room already in San Bernardino Justice Center, and then we're also asking for a second children's waiting room. We found space in our historic courthouse, which is the old criminal courthouse, which is now the family courthouse. So there'd be one in the new Justice Center and then one in the family courthouse in San Bernardino. As you can see, we're asking for the $5 be allocated for that from the general civil unlimited fee. And we're estimating the cost would be a little less than the allocation if we did the $5. And you can see the historic numbers, excuse me, on page combined 71. We also came to the estimates from doing a request for information and looking at what Orange County pays for those services. So we've done our homework on that. We believe that we can do two full children's waiting rooms for the possible allocation with the $5.
Any questions for Chris about that proposal? It is an action item. Any motions?
I just have a clarification. I talked to Chris earlier on page 71, Merced Court. Our money was given back to the Judicial Council, and so as of January.
Okay. Very good.
We tried three RFPs and couldn't get a waiting room open.
Okay.
And actually, ours is listed wrong as well. Ours should be at $3, $2, I'm sorry. So just as a clarification.
Okay. We'll make sure those changes are made. Any other questions? Any motion? Is there a motion to adopt?
I'll move the recommendation.
I'll okay. Second.
Judge Good and Sherry Carter seconded. Any further questions or discussions? All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Carries.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. All right. Now the last two items on the agenda, as I said before, these are our end of the day items. I'm open to any discussion that you have. I'm also very cognizant of the fact that the storm has come in and many of you want to get going. So I'll stay as long as anybody has any questions. The first is, and it is actually an action item, it's to approve and adopt the annual agenda as it's noted in the item 7 memo. This then proceeds to E&P. E&P will apparently then discuss the agenda with me at an in-person meeting on April 13th. I work very closely with Lucy on this. If this agenda looks similar and familiar, it's because it is. It's modeled, obviously, after each year's agenda. It's a continuation of some items, though you will see also that one of our tasks from E&P is going to be to, I'm referring you specifically to item 7, the $10 million reserve fund, which is sort of the other side of the issue we discussed this morning about the 1%. So now this is it's anticipated that the 2% will convert to that $10 million fund. It will be a bank account, so to speak, from which it's preceded with $10 million. And then as withdrawals are made from it, then comes back out of our funds to refill the bathtub, so to speak, with that $10 million. So I think there's some things that, just so you know, what we'll probably do is just convert the 2% committee to that. There's an issue that just came up that we will be addressing, and I appreciate any comments that you have if you want to send me an email, but we had, and I'm sure you're all aware, a county that suffered a catastrophic loss of its case management system or its information systems due to a crime. Some, you probably all heard about it, but they were devastated. It cost them a significant amount of money, so they asked for a 2%, and the question that then came to the 2% committee was, is the purpose of 2% to make whole or to keep afloat? So should you have to take out of your existing funds everything you can and then come to 2% with that amount of money that you can't get? Or do you come to 2% and say, we lost $500,000 because of this crisis, we want you to give us $500,000? They're both very legitimate asks. So I think that's going to be something we're going to address is when somebody suffers what would otherwise be reimbursable, so to speak, from the 2%, are they reimbursed the loss that they suffered? Or are they reimbursed the amount of money necessary to bring them back up to level? Now we did, and the 2% did grant in that case, they also allowed them the funding necessary to protect their 1%. So they got that as well. But they were not provided, and they actually modified their ask at the end to not ask for the full amount of money. They only asked for that amount of money necessary so they could not have to make cuts. So I just throw that out there as an issue that I think that will have to be addressed. Also, other tasks from E&P that are sent to us, language access funding, reallocation of new judgeships, we'll be talking about that, and the $30 million innovative grant funds and what's our role in that. So this is the agenda proposed for the year. Any questions? David, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Judge, I wanted to go back to item number 7, the state level reserve policy. Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, courts that petitioned for deficiency funding request generally, and I could be wrong, it doesn't go by the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee for review or consideration?
Correct. It goes to the 2%. It went to the subcommittee, and they're the ones that then made the recommendation directly to the Judicial Council. So last week, the recommendation was made from the subcommittee to the Judicial Council to adopt the recommendation.
Okay, and was there a, not being on there, was there consideration or discussion about whether courts get a loan or it's just kind of a free, not free, but a general recommendation that they give to authorize the request?
I hate to sound like a judge, but the decision was case-by-case basis. I'm sorry, go ahead.
In this particular case, they've got some litigation obviously pending, and so I believe the agreement was going to be that should they be receive any money through the pending litigation, which can, as you know, can take years, that would be the fund would be paid back. But truly, I don't think any of us expect that any time in the near future anyway.
Dave, having done this a couple times, all those questions and more, and at the end of the day, they didn't get what they asked for because we felt what we recommended was the more appropriate way to go. So regardless of the court of the issue, we always look at loans, temporaries, paybacks, cash advances. We look at the fund condition statement. We look at reserves. We look at the whole nine yards. And so we are pretty tight in that regard.
Thank you.
You bet.
So I'll make a motion to forward the work plan as presented to the TMB for
motion by Mike Lennon.
Your review.
I'll second.
Second by Judge Earl and by Tonya. All right. All in favor of forwarding this agenda to E&P, aye?
Aye.
Any opposition? All right. Thank you so much. We'll forward that agenda. Okay. It's now time for open discussion. I do want to bring one item to everybody's attention and then any concerns anybody has. We are just going down the path, and I want to find it, working, not with, but I guess alongside JCTC concerning a proposal by Jake Chatters about, as described, the creation of a 7-core information technology infrastructure consortium. It's a very innovative proposal. It's a proposal that I believe will ultimately save money for IMF and the branch. And Jake is at the beginning stages. Jake approached me last week, and we talked since then. I've also talked to Justice Slough, as he has talked to Justice Slough. As a matter of fact, the proposal I got from him was to Justice Slough, then Judge Slough. And as chair of JCTC and to me as chair of Trial Court Budget Advisory, so I told Jake I would notify the committee today that that's something we will be addressing at a later time. But the reason we didn't have it on our agenda is it came out just too late. By the time Jake got it to me, the agenda for today's meeting had been set, the materials have been distributed, but I wanted you folks to know that that's coming, and I told Jake I would let him know. I don't know if Jake's on the phone, but he was willing to stand by. Sherry?
I think that is a really good initiative, and my understanding is why Jake needs the approval fairly quickly as he needs to sign contracts. Is there something that we need to do to help him to facilitate this collaboration? Should we have a conference call? I mean, can he wait until our next meeting?
I don't believe so. So that actually is the thought, is have a conference call. The thought is to have a conference call and perhaps settle it by vote. As far as following the rules, we'd have to set it, but have a call meeting to adopt it. Because I agree, it's a good proposal. Candidly, we just need time to flesh it out.
I'm not clear. What's the issue for the Budget Advisory Committee?
He is asking concerning funding for it.
upfront money,
right,
for signing contracts that would then get the sustained smaller courts that are currently hosted by judicial counsel to move to a collaborative approach where his court would host them.
Got you.
So he needs money up front to sign contracts and buy what he needs to do so that it will end up saving the branch a lot of money.
It'll come out of the IMF initially, which is why he comes to us.
Judge Kaufman? I'm one of those courts, and I know Judge Buckley's here, and there's a conference call on Friday.
Yes.
And so perhaps Judge Buckley could be our front person to talk to everybody and say, let's get this up and running. Maybe we could have a telephone conference or a voice vote like we did on Monday or Tuesday and get this done. Because the sooner we get it done, the sooner we're helped, but also the sooner there's relief from the IMF, too.
Great. So, I'll stay in touch with you two then about that.
Okay.
All right. Anything of general concern of the body besides trying to catch planes and get out of here?
Okay. I have minutia.
Minutia's good.
My ID card from when I was a PJ is about to expire. So I was wondering if you'd be willing to talk to the chief or Martin and see if we could get authorization for members of the committee to have ID cards to get into the building.
Sure, because maybe I shouldn't say this, but mine has expired and it still works. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that.
I need to say that.
Sorry.
Mine still works.
We will appropriate, following all necessary security measures, we'll get that addressed. Everybody's looking at their cards now. All right. We're adjourning up. Sam?
Yes, I wanted to put forward the issue that has affected us in Riverside quite a bit this year, and that is a unintended consequence of traffic amnesty.
Which, and I need to apologize because I told Sam I'd address this. He sent me a letter. So, Sam, thank you very much for reminding me. Go ahead.
The traffic amnesty program resulted in our ability not to collect civil assessments. Let me say from the outset that the traffic amnesty program has been enormously successful in Riverside. As of yesterday, we've had 10,506 cases. And I know that there's a lot of, of the intent of that legislation has been realized, it would seem. But a byproduct of it has been the impact on civil assessment. So far, we're running about 500,000 a month down. From where we were last year. So in the 5 months, we're down just over 2.5 million. We expect to be down between 4 and 5 million this fiscal year. And the concern is to find a way to replace the revenue that has been lost. And of course, we're talking about an issue that has got some collateral discussion about the future of civil assessments and how, as a branch, we deal with civil assessments branch-wide. And I just would just urge that as these discussions go forward that for courts such as ours that have depended on this revenue over the years, and maybe more so than, for example, it's 15.5% of our budget. So if there's a contraction in it, we feel it pretty fast. And there are those that have said, well, you shouldn't depend on it. Well, we're not going to be depending on it this year as much as we have in the past, out of necessity. But it would be good to get if a way could be found to replace the revenue so it's not such an abrupt drop in revenue overall for a court to have to deal with at one time.
And it's a very appropriate comment. I think as you saw, I got up and talked to Rebecca as you were commenting, because as you're aware as well, we have a working group of the workload allocation subcommittee addressing this issue precisely. Civil assessments as a whole, traffic amnesty, and there's many of you who are drilling down on that, so to speak. So I think you're right. It's to say it's the elephant in the room is an understatement. It's a big elephant in a small room. So thank you very much for reminding me, Sam, because you're right. We talked about me bringing that up. Any other matters of general concern? The date of our next meeting is May 19th, which will be a significant date because then we'll have the revise will be out.
Where will that be?
Sacramento. Not Fresno yet, but that's all I'll say.
Sorry, San Francisco.
Oh, Okay. I guess it'll be just go. We'll continue. July is in Sacramento. Yes.
Have we received notice of that new date?
No.
I don't think any of us have it.
Yeah, I got it.
Oh, well.
Some do, some don't. We adjusted it because of the May revise, right?
Yeah.
You should have it, but if not, so everybody's clear. Our next meeting, May 19th here in San Francisco. All right, everybody, thank you so much. I know you traveled near and far, mostly far. Please travel safely going home, and all the best. We are adjourned.